sail the seven seas. Yeah, I want to be a pirate. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it in the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the program. We're going to bring you interviews from the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, D.C. This is a recorded program. We will be back live in the studio on Monday taking your phone calls. So if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I hope you enjoy the interviews from today's program. But before we get to that, I just got to share... I got to share the story of getting down here. You know, we left on Wednesday night to get down here during the snowstorm, where it was enjoyable watching people slide into each other and other folks not knowing how to drive, and a city completely crippled and shut down by a little bit of snow, which I got to tell you, you know, coming to a high-density area, a little bit of snow can wreak absolute havoc. But to tell you the difference in mindsets between living in an open area where we do in the Harrisburg-Carlisle area and in a major city with high-density population, I pulled into the parking lot because, of course, here at the hotel, they wouldn't take my truck because it was evidently too long. Either that or it was too poor-looking for them. But they wouldn't take the car here at the hotel, so I had to find a parking spot. So across the street there was a spot where I pulled into the garage, and the guy comes running out with a clipboard. Oh, stop, stop, stop. And he takes down my license number, and he takes down my license plate. And, you know, this all this information they're filling out to park your car, which, again, you know, is kind of culture shockish. And the libertarian part of me not thrilled, but look, hey, I'm a block from the Capitol. You got to expect this stuff. And to tell you how sometimes I'm not all there. The guy goes, hey, I got to check the back of your truck there. So I said, yeah, do what you got to do, man. So he goes back, and he's looking into my truck, and all of a sudden I hear, oh, a whole bunch of people come running out. Darned if I didn't forget to take the propane tanks from the gas grill out of the back from the food drive. I had three propane tanks back there and two big 5-gallon red, you know, bright red gasoline tanks back there, containers back there, which, you know, hey, you know, in looking at it from an outsider's view, probably not the brightest thing I've ever done, but it did catch some attention, and as you would expect. So it was kind of interesting. Almost found myself locked up, you know, with bags of rock salt in the back and all of that, like most of us have in our truck at this time of year. I thought it was an interesting, funny little story, but it tells you the differences in going place to place and some of the things you've got to think about. But here at the conference, one of the things that I have really enjoyed here, while this is a very centrist group, not a lot of single-payer folks that I've run into, some, but for the most part, very, very positive on the Affordable Care Bill. When I think of this, and as I'm looking forward, when the exchanges start, and this is the important part of all of this, and this is why I was I was really concerned, especially looking at what happened on Wednesday when we left town in the House, a day after the president's talking about unity, about bringing the country together. After the governor had said, you know, look, we're gonna work together and we're gonna do all these things above boards and there's gonna be reform and you got the Republicans in the state House saying we're going to end debate, saying we're going to streamline things. And I love that phrase, we're going to streamline things, which basically means we're going to ram through our agenda. And their agenda is one of privatization. Their agenda is one of selling off all of state assets at fire sale prices. And expect it. It's coming. You know, they've already told you. And they've already come back on the idea that there's going to be $2 billion at the end of the road. There's going to be this pot of gold at the end of the wine and spirit shop privatization move. There's not. That $2 billion is not there. And they're already stepping back from it. You see the Commonwealth Foundation, the Tinky Tank over there. They've already stepped back, $1.7 billion. I've seen reports of somewhere around $1.5 billion. I'm telling you, you're not even going to get a billion. It's not going to happen. And as we go forward in this, we're going to have to hold that number, hold them accountable for this. Because they're going to have to pay a stiff penalty if this gets rammed through. And I think it's going to be rammed through, much like the vouchers are going to be rammed through. Understand, these vouchers, again, you know, this whole privatization scheme is about taking what is public and giving it to the private for-profit interests now that there's not much left to do. It's about rewarding their cronies. It's about rewarding their campaign donors and punishing the rest of us. At the bottom of the road here, at the end of all of this, we, the local taxpayers, are going to be the ones stuck. Because Corbett's taking that bizarre anti-tax pledge where he's saying, no, we're not going to raise any taxes, we're not going to raise any fees, no Marcellus Shale, none of that. Which means less money for the states, less money for the local communities. And what does that mean? That means you and I are going to pay higher local taxes, higher school taxes. You know they're going to go after cutting education, especially if they're going to divide the funding for education. Look, you're going to start all these charter schools. Understand, that school still has the same bill. Understand, they still have to pay the heating costs, the property costs, the upkeep, the maintenance, all of that. None of that stuff changes once you start a charter school. In fact, what it does is it doubles the costs. You know, and there's so much of this privatization scheme coming down. I go back to the state stores again, the liquor stores, the wine and spirit shops, whatever you want to call them. Here in Washington, D.C., there's one on every street corner. We got dry cleaning and liquor. We got deli and liquor. We got, you know, whatever service you want and then liquor on top of it. And that's what Pennsylvania is going to look like. You know, this idea that we can keep it to 750, nonsense. In order to get to that 2 billion number, it is going to take thousands. And that's what we're going to be talking about next week when we get back into the studio. Again, tonight we're going to be playing some interviews from the Families USA Healthcare Conference here in Washington, D.C. This is a recorded program. We will be back in the studio Monday night to take your phone calls. But again, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I look forward to your input. Look forward to your ideas on the conversations we've had the last couple of days. You know, I like coming to these conferences. I like getting a whole bunch of different ideas to bring home, to have the discussions that we're really going to have in the coming weeks and months, especially as states move towards setting up this health care exchange, as we begin to push Governor Corbett and the Republicans who don't want health care reform in our state to doing what they have to do by law, which is set up these exchanges. And we're going to have to hold them accountable every step of the way. Because these are people who don't believe in it, folks. These are people who want to deny you some basic health care. These are look at this adult basic thing. Absolutely an amazing scenario. We're going to talk a little bit about that. A whole bunch of stuff, so stick around. If you missed any portion of the program, you want to download it from the podcast, TheRickSmithShow.com is right there for your entertainment. We look forward to your feedback. Sit back, relax, enjoy the conversations, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say and what your thoughts are on Monday. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back. Stick around. As you
listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It just gives me more energy to continue doing my job.
United Steelworkers Subdistrict Director Manny Armenta, freed after being arrested this week in Mexico while on his way to meet with lawyers for the Los Mineros Mexican Miners Union. He was arrested supposedly for driving a stolen car, but the car was leased to the union. After having the car impounded and being held in a cell for several hours, he was free, but $700 in cash was stolen from his wallet. The USW is filing a formal protest over the arrest with the U.S. State Department. Armenta and the USW are working to support Los Mineros. The Mexican miners are waging a nearly four-year strike with giant mining company Grupo Mexico. Armenta says the workers have suffered violent suppression from the company and the Mexican government.
There's been fatalities. There's been a lot of tear gas in some of the places they try to organize, and even in the places they're already organized and represent the workers. This week is just an indication of how corrupt the Mexican government is, along with the company, the Grupo Mexico, a very powerful company, and they obviously control a lot of the government officials.
The USW is determined to continue to stand in solidarity with Los Mineros. The AFL-CIO and the International Association of Machinists are suing South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley for saying that the state will try to keep unions out of the new Boeing plant in Charleston. The suit in U.S. District Court seeks a court order telling the governor and her director of the South Carolina Department of Labor, Licensing and Regulation to remain neutral when it comes to union activities. Dubai is a city defined by its expensive living and eclectic ambition, but it isn't as well known for its willingness to let worker abuses slide. Jesse Russell reports.
Construction workers in Dubai received a reminder about the lack of labor rights in the United Arab Emirates this week. An estimated 5,000 Arab tech construction workers went on strike in mid-January to demand a pay increase that would amount to $54 extra per month. Construction workers in Dubai, who are typically brought in from South Asia, earn on average the equivalent of $190 to $220 per month. Arab Tech Holding is the largest construction company in Dubai, and the workers are used for everything from building the skyscrapers that are increasingly springing up on the city's skyline to hotels. Public labor unrest is a rarity in the Emirates because workers often fear they'll be deported or arrested. In this case, 50 of the workers who went on strike are being sent packing due to their willingness to demand better wages in a country that has become known for its rampant excess.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm sitting here with Bob Wiener, a guy who wrote an interesting piece in the Washington Times declaring Osama bin Laden dead, which I think a lot of us believe. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rick. And I love your area in Pennsylvania. I've been to Harrisburg, and I'm really glad to be with your listeners.
So any documentation on the claim that he's dead, or just the reality we haven't seen anything from him in a while?
Well, that was our point, that we haven't seen a video of him since 03, and there are these intel verifications that the tapes are legitimate. Hey, Sarah Palin and Tina Fey sounded exactly alike and looked exactly alike, and the staff couldn't even tell the difference on Saturday Night Live. So I'm convinced that we're being scammed by Al-Qaeda, and the reason is because they want to instill fear in the United States. It destroys our economy. We're building. That's actually what we're doing to ourselves, is these two wars are costing us trillions. That's most of our budget deficit, that plus the rich tax breaks. And any great country will, whether it's France or Britain or the Soviet Union or Spain, they went down. Their colonial empires got destroyed when their militaries got too big.
Right.
And that's what we're doing to ourselves in the United States, is spending so much on being the military for the world. And that's what using the bin Laden is a live scam. It allows our military to do. It creates the fear. Without the head guy, there's no vehicle for the American people to feel afraid and spend all this money on war and warrantless wiretappings and intelligence and all these dark budgets that CNN does a better job on intel than the CIA does. You find out first what's going on because they got cameras everywhere in the world.
Right.
And so that's why we wrote the piece, because there is absolutely no evidence that he's alive since 03 when the last live video. So we put out a challenge to Al-Qaeda. We said, put up or shut up. Give us another video or he's dead.
Okay, I agree. But here's the thing. You can't have a Superman without Lex Luthor. I mean, that's
the
reality.
You've made the point.
You can't be a hero without a villain.
That's right.
And that's what they've used him for the longest time.
That's right. And it's so, you know,
and
I'm sending a letter.
And drained our national coffers.
Yeah,
it's done a whole bunch of things.
That's exactly
and you
right.
come here to this conference where they're talking about health care, and for the whole debate they kept telling us we can't afford it.
Well, there's another bogeyman. The president just today, we were in a position right now where we walk up the stairs and we're reacting to him because he just spoke, made the point that the Republicans want to say it's a job-crushing, granny-threatening, budget-busting monstrosity. It doesn't match up to the reality of what the bill does. Is it provides pre-existing condition coverage, ends the donut hole for seniors so they can get full drugs, keeps children on parents' plans through 26, gives lifetime coverage with no arbitrary ceiling, and preventive care so you don't go from stage 1 to stage 4 cancer. That's what the bill does. That's why when you talk about the provisions in the bill, the American people support it by 70-80%. But if you're going to talk about the bill as a whole, well, nobody's for socialism and huge government. So of course if you use buzzwords like that, but that's not what this bill does. It drives down the middle through the private insurance companies. It didn't even go as far into single payer or Medicare buy-in the way that
we wanted.
And in fact, which was Hillary's bill. Obama's bill was two-thirds of Hillary's. Obama had two-thirds and McCain had nothing. That's what the campaign was about. And yet, this major step that Obama did, the Republicans are playing as though it's big socialism, and it's not.
Well, I mean, and you just ticked off a number of very positive things that this bill does, and as I understand, you were over at Fake News on Fox, where they wouldn't even allow you to do that.
Well, I'd invite your listeners to go to my website, wienerpublic.com, WEINERpublic.com, one word, .com, or go to Jon Stewart's website, either way, and go on to the January 17th Daily Show, with Jon Stewart, where he used me for 2 minutes, 5.5 minutes into his opening segment. It's a highlight. One highlight of my life was when I challenged Ken Starr, was on the courthouse steps, and I was the lead of Brokaw and Jennings, and Jay Leno made a joke of it on Tonight's Show, saying only in the Clinton oral sex case would there be a wiener testifying. What was Dick Armey not available? And here's Bob Wiener leaving the courthouse, and they had the wiener reveal. So that was highlight one. And then highlight two is Jon Stewart using my ticking off the list and being cut off by Fox, although I did finish the list in the next question. I made a point of it that I just read to your readers, to your listeners. But Stewart said, what part, he was saying, making the joke, what part of we don't want our viewers, Fox, to know what's in the bill, don't you understand?
Yeah, I mean, and it comes back down to, on a number of topics, on a number of issues across the table, how misinformed the American public is because of outlets like Fake News on Fox.
In preparing for that interview, when they called me between flights, I was in North Carolina and then was going to land in D.C., I had nobody else to practice on, so I practiced on the flight attendant and told him, here's what's in the bill. And he said, gee, I didn't know that. If I knew that, I'd say it's a great bill. People don't know. But when they're polled on the provisions, as I said, 70-80% support those provisions, and really only 20-30% want a repeal of the bill. People don't want repeal of health care because they know that it's, as the president said, it's the right thing to do for our country.
It absolutely is. And, you know, but, you know, Wendell Potter said we lost the message.
Great hero.
Yeah, absolutely.
His break from the insurance companies is remarkable.
A great person. But at the... When you look at it, he's right. We lost the messaging war right from the beginning because we were talking
yes.
about facts. We were talking about how do we
right.
take care of people? How do we help people?
Right.
And the other side of the aisle was how do we scare the hell out of people?
Right. You're exactly right. And
and it goes back to this Bin Laden thing as well.
Yeah.
How do we keep people afraid?
I'm cleared as a daily reporter because of my op-eds for the White House news conferences. So I was at a White House news conference with a Time magazine reporter a year ago, and she said to me, the president has not made a point of saying what's in the bill. He hasn't said pre-existing conditions, cover seniors' drugs, keep your children on the plan to 26, lifetime coverage and preventive care. If you only say what's in the bill, you win the argument, but we did not do that until now. And what the Republicans have made a huge strategic error of doing is in calling up this repeal, they have given us, as many senators have said, a second chance to make a first impression.
Yep.
So now we're doing it, and the polls are driving radically up. And Obama, by the way, since the lame duck, has gone up 15 points in the polls. So his speech of the State of the Union, where he explains what he's doing, and his speech here, and his going out around the country, and all of those of us who you've given the privilege of talking to you on the radio, it makes a huge difference in the American people really supporting what they want, which is health care for their children, their grandparents, and themselves.
Yeah, the tables kind of have turned a little bit because
that's right.
Now you're taking something away from somebody. Folks,
that's
now,
right.
We've got now I can't put my children on my health care, as you said, till 26. And they can no longer take my health care rescission
right.
away.
That's right.
Most people before this whole debate had no idea what rescission
yeah.
was.
Well, they can threaten. And for don't think, you know, that they can't really take it away now because there are vehicles they can use, even though Obama will veto the bill, even though there are no votes in the Senate for repeal. The tinkering on the edges is very real, and the removal of the mandate, the 20 attorney general's lawsuit that's active and moving up in the courts that could reach this 5-4 Republican Supreme Court
right.
that went Bush v. Gore, so don't think it's only something on the merits that happens, could be a threat to the bill. Now, how much of a threat? Howard Dean was out there saying that only 4% of the people are really covered by the mandate. But actually, you take away that mandate, which is the well people paying for the sick people. That's kind of what insurance does, whether it's title insurance in your house or your driver's license, whatever kind of insurance you have. It's the people that don't use it that actually pay for the people that do. I mean, that's
right.
the point of insurance. That's what makes it legitimate interstate commerce. But the merits are not what's going to operate here if they want to make a statement, a political statement, if the court wants to go the route of voting 5-4 to knock out the mandate in the bill. But so that 4% of the people that would be covered under the mandate will add prices up a little bit. And that's the irony of what the Republicans are doing, is everything they're doing would cost more.
Right.
And they're trying to say that the bill costs money. They're going to cost the money. And CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, nonpartisan, says that the bill, as the president said today in his speech, will save $250 billion this decade and $1 trillion in the next decade, stopping rising premiums. They're going to rise a little because stuff happens, but they're going to stop the rise from doubling every decade, which is what they've been doing because
right.
the insurance companies have been making such an obscene profit. And this bill says they can only charge, they can charge 80%. They have to give back 80% of the benefits in health care,
right.
and they can only charge 20% administrative costs, which, by the way, is no hardship. Medicare is 3-5% administrative costs. So the insurance companies are fighting tooth and nail against the bill's provisions because they're going to make a little less money, but they're still going to make a fat, tidy sum.
Well, they're going to make a fat, tidy sum because now they've got more customers and more government money going into it.
That's right.
Which is why I think part of this, we're starting to see a shift, or at least I think I'm seeing a shift in the insurance companies going, okay, we can deal with this bill.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I got a friend who works for one of the Blues, and he said back during the Medicare fight, back in the 60s, the Blues were dead set, vehemently opposed to Medicare because they thought it was going to destroy them. But now they're one of the biggest handlers of the Medicare system. So that's why they really haven't come out against it. In fact, in a lot of cases, they're actually for it because they're finding a way to profit from it. Look, corporations are going to find a way to make money off of this one way or another. And I'm not against that. But it's the excessive amounts. It's that, dollar Bill McGuire taking $1.7 billion over a decade and his replacement taking $500 million over the last 5 years. That's what I have a problem with.
There's $1.5 billion fraud that this new governor of Florida, who was an insurance exec, his company made before he... Somehow that's a base to run for and win governor of Florida. I can't figure that one out, by the way. But, you know, you're exactly right about, after the fact, people liking the bill. I went with Maggie Kuhn, who was the great Gray Panther. She was the founder and chair of, and president of the Gray Panthers. And I went with her... 15 years ago, to Canada, literally a couple of years before she died. We went around, and it was the same thing there. They hated it at first. The doctors hated it. The insurance companies hated it. Everybody hated it. Now you can't take that insurance plan away from Canada. They love their insurance, and the myth that we do it better, we're 49th in life expectancy in the United States, so we don't do it better. We're paying the middleman of our insurance companies now, and we pay twice as much as any country, other countries on earth that have health insurance plans. And we're 49th in life expectancy. So we're not getting what we pay for. This bill will help. And after it's around for a while, and even now the polls are shifting with just the provisions that have kicked in now, let alone what's going to be kicking in over the next 3 years,
right.
People will love it. They will want it. They will, and you won't be able to drag it away from them.
And they'll fight to protect it, just like we're seeing
right.
with Social Security.
That's right. So the Republicans know this is their last best chance to take it away, but it's probably too late anyway because those great provisions have already kicked in on seniors and kids and lifetime and preventive. So with those provisions in there, it's tougher and tougher now, but they'll go down. It's like a boxer who's punching but moving to the ropes as he punches. That's what the Republicans are doing now.
So do you think they're going to see the backlash in the next election? I mean,
hopefully
the electorate remembers this.
Well, they will, because Republicans will still be calling it Obamacare. I think that's a good thing. That's a badge of honor.
Sure.
President Obama got national health care started. How many presidents have tried
since
and
Teddy
failed?
Roosevelt? Sure.
And even Hillary tried hard under Bill Clinton and couldn't do it. So,
well,
you know, as they said in the speech, it was a as your previous guest just said, who helped found this conference, that it was a strategic decision to go the route that he did, which was through the private sector, because he knew that way at least you could get the votes. Now, we'll have to ultimately go there. As this budget, health care is 1/6 of the national economy, and as health care continues to strangle us piece by piece, we're probably going to get to a single payer. We'll probably get to the equivalent of a Medicare buy-in, and that's the kind of health insurance that most other countries have. But we're so profit business oriented in this country, we had to give 160 amendments to the business community, tax breaks. And, you know, one point on tax breaks, Rick, they jammed the stimulus. 40% of the stimulus was a compromise that was tax breaks for Republicans.
Yep.
They jammed the health bill. There are 161 amendments in the health bill that are tax breaks for small business. So as the president said, that small businesses now can cover 30%. They're getting a 30% reduction on health care for their employees by the tax breaks in the bill. They keep saying this stuff, but it ain't true. And by the way, the tax breaks didn't create the employment, because we're still at 9.4. So
right.
If tax breaks are such a great strategy, why are we still at 9.4 since we gave them all the tax breaks?
But if tax breaks were the answer, the Bush years would have been the best years in the history of the country.
And the Reagan years where the deficit tripled. Tax breaks have been the worst economic strategy, and you can graph it where during the Democratic presidencies where,
but that's
you, do,
not the point,
where you do people programs and you give tax breaks to the low and middle, you have a 4 times greater growth in gross national product than you do in the Republican years where they're doing jack up the military and tax breaks for the rich. We've grafted, and I invite your listeners to go to my website, again, wienerpublic.com, and look at the piece on the great tax debate myths.
Yeah, I will most certainly look at that, and we'll put a link at our site at therickspithshow.com. But at the end of it, you got to know who they're paying homage to. You've got to give your pound of flesh to the top 2%, who are the ones who fund Republican campaigns.
That's right.
That's the bottom line.
You'll see me very quiet on that point because you're so right about it.
Bob Wiener, President Wiener & Associates, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much. Great article, by the way.
Thank you so much. It was really fun to talk with you. We're shaking hands so your listeners know that.
Love to have you back again in the near future.
Pleasure.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Isn't it nice to know that whenever America faces a big issue, Americans can always count on Congress to be there. For themselves, that is. Take health care. Corporate-funded front groups churned out a mess of lies to foment public opposition to Obama's rather modest insurance reform, demonizing it as a government takeover of our health care system. It was no such thing, but that hasn't stopped Republican lawmakers from making a theatrical show of trying to repeal Obama's reform and, quote, save the people from the horrors of socialized medicine. Yet, in all their blathering, none of them have offered to save themselves from the horror of taxpayer-provided health care. Congress critters get Cadillac coverage at our expense. Plus, they have their own in-house bevy of government doctors to attend to them. Why don't they vote to eliminate this privileged bastion of socialism? Then there's the real horror of gun violence that exploded most recently in Arizona. In response, members of Congress rushed forward with creative solutions. It's all about public safety, they exclaimed, by which they meant saving themselves from the public. Representative Peter King showed what he's made of by introducing legislation making it a federal crime to carry a gun within the vicinity of a congressperson. Representative Dan Burton proposed an emergency job creation program, which would consist of immediately sealing off the House gallery with bulletproof glass to shield the skittish Solons from the people. And a couple of members took a bold stand for individual responsibility by announcing that they would henceforth show their respect for constituents by packing pistols when going out amongst them. This is Jim Hightower saying, good grief! Don't they do enough damage by shooting off their mouths? I don't know about you, but I don't think Congress people should be trusted with real guns.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. Health conference put on by Families USA. I'm sitting here with Brian Smedley, Vice President and Director of Health Policy Institute, also from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies here in Washington. Brian, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick.
You know, I go back to when I was a kid. They used to have school lunch programs, thanks to the Johnson's Great Society program. And I remember President Reagan coming in, and just before we sat down, I remember ketchup's a vegetable. I almost can pinpoint that as a moment when the country probably took a wrong turn.
That's right. Unfortunately, it's, you know, that's among the many examples of misinformation that if you repeat it enough, the public will believe it. And the reality is that we've got to do more to ensure that kids are healthy in the first place and have access to healthy foods. This is part of the issue that we're trying to address here, in that very little money in our healthcare system is spent on prevention, ensuring that people are healthy in the first place. We spend 95 cents out of every healthcare dollar on taking care of people after they've become sick. So it makes little sense, and you're absolutely right, that we can go back to the early 80s and see that shift in public thinking and shift really in where we put our investments in terms of health.
Absolutely. And, you know, with talking about obesity and a lot of the things that are going on, prevention, you know, maybe making vegetables again instead of ketchup. I mean, because when you have the mindset that a condiment with high fructose corn syrup, corn sugar,
right,
since it's no longer high fructose corn syrup, it's corn sugar, and I think there's a problem there.
You know, and that's the thing. We've gotten away from healthy, unrefined foods, and so much of what our kids eat are highly processed, high-fat, non-nutritious foods. And, you know, there is a movement, thanks to the work of the First Lady and others, toward getting back to serving fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, picked right out of the garden. And that's what we got to get back to. And unfortunately, so many of our kids rarely see a fresh fruit or vegetable these days.
Well, I got to be honest, I'm a living testament of that. And this is why this is important to me. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and ketchup was a vegetable. We didn't have it in the house because couldn't afford it. So part of this is also socioeconomics.
Yep.
It's the fact that poorer families, poorer communities, and struggling working families can't afford this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and this is something that we've got to address. Just to give you an example, my hometown of Detroit currently doesn't have a single major grocery store or supermarket within the city limits. So if people want to get fresh fruits and vegetables, you really have to have reliable personal transportation because there's no public transportation infrastructure. So we've got to get back to trying to ensure that people have access to healthy foods regardless of their income, regardless of their means, because we're all going to benefit from a healthier community and lower health care costs when people don't have to get sick.
You know, how do we go about that, though? I know some communities that I've been a part of, they started co-ops where they were trying to have farmers bring things in. I'm sure there's no single play here, but there've got to be ideas.
There are some really good ideas, and in fact, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has really led the nation with a really smart idea when the state established a fresh food financing initiative, provided tax incentives for grocery stores to locate in so-called food deserts. These are communities that didn't have access to healthy food. That idea has taken root, and now the Obama administration has got a federal fresh food financing initiative modeled after what happened in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So there are many communities now in Pennsylvania that do have a grocery store, and a lot of these grocery stores are achieving the so-called triple bottom line. Not only are they turning a profit in those communities, but they're also providing jobs and providing access to healthy foods for those residents.
That's a win-win situation. You know, I go back to the how do we get, you know, nutritious foods in front of kids. And the school lunch programs, to me, where I grew up, you know, in the summertime, there was one hot meal a day that people could depend on. And that was whatever was given out at the local school, and kids lined up because that was there.
Yep.
And it wasn't much, and I'm sure it wasn't expensive, but it was something.
That's right.
And for those kids, it was the only hot meal. A lot of my friends that they got that day.
Absolutely. And when you think about what it costs to provide a hot, nutritious meal for a kid versus the cost of paying for someone's health problems because they didn't have a good diet as a child, there's no comparison. If we invest in the front end, making sure that kids in particular have healthy, nutritious foods, we're going to save a lot of money on the back end. And when we hear politicians here in Washington talking about bending the cost curve and reducing health care costs, it's mind-boggling that they don't realize that we need to start with prevention, start with ensuring that people have an opportunity for a healthy life.
Because the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm a couple more than a couple pounds overweight myself, and because of the eating habits I picked up as a child. No defending that, but it was the welfare diet. You ate what was cheap and what was filling. And so you hear people saying, well, why are there so many obese children in poor areas? And it's not how much they're eating, it's what.
That's right, absolutely. Because what's available to these kids is Taco Bell, Burger King, you know, carry out stores selling high-fat foods. It's we know that people need to eat healthy. We know that individual responsibility is important. But if all that's available in the community is unhealthy food, you can't blame the parents or the kids if they have a poor diet. We got to do better in ensuring that neighborhoods are healthy and provide healthy food options.
And it comes back down to economics and building infrastructure. You know, where I grew up, there wasn't a bus line.
Mm-hmm.
So you were segregated from any opportunity of decent jobs because you couldn't get there.
That's right. Absolutely. You know, we find that your zip code is a more powerful predictor of your health than your genetic code. Where you live is important. It dictates access to so many resources, not just around health, but as you pointed out, economic opportunities. And that is a powerful predictor of your health.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Brian Smedley, Vice President and Director of the Health Policy Institute of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. You know, in bringing that back to what we're doing here at this conference and this health care law that we're trying to get moving forward, how much is in this to help address the problems that we're talking about? How much prevention are we looking at?
Yeah, well, the law, the Affordable Care Act, calls for some $11 billion to go into what's called a prevention and public health fund. And this would do a lot of things, but among them are grants called community transformation grants that are intended to do just the kind of thing that we're talking about, trying to ensure that kids have access to healthy food, trying to provide tax credits for grocery stores to locate in communities that don't have them, trying to ensure that people have access to parks and recreational facilities so that they can exercise. These are things that many folks take for granted, but as you pointed out, you know, so many communities lack access to these kinds of resources to protect your health. And this law ensures that those resources will go to those communities, but only if the provisions are fully funded. And that's the battle right now, because many expect that the House, with the new Republican leadership, is not going to fully fund things like the Prevention and Public Health Fund, and that's a terrible mistake in our view.
Well, that's one of the things that I'm most concerned about. You look at most of the problems that we have on the state government level with the huge budget deficits, and it's because we've elected people who don't believe in what they're doing. They don't believe in government running it.
That's
and
right.
Basically running it into the ground.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, if you think government is terrible at everything that it does, then, of course, you're cynical and you see little value in these kinds of programs. But in the reality, the private sector isn't doing it. It'd be wonderful if they were. It'd be wonderful if the private sector decided, you know what, let's put some grocery stores in Detroit or Cleveland or Chicago or many other cities where people lack access to healthy food. But without that tax incentive from government, they don't see the case for doing that. So there are many ways that government can lead, and importantly, the Affordable Care Act is one of those areas that provides resources for government, but contrary to the myths that are going around, it doesn't put the government in the driver's seat to dictate, for example, what you eat or whether you go to the doctor. It's really
what?
About
what?
Facilitating
what? I'm not going to have a government bureaucrat between me and my doctor?
That's right.
You mean a government bureaucrat isn't going to replace the insurance company bureaucrat between
That's
me and
right.
my doctor?
And who would you trust more? So part of the issue is informing folks that, in fact, this law strengthens private health insurance. Nobody's completely happy about the law except for the private health insurance companies, because they're making out very well under this new law.
Yeah, they'll do pretty well, even though you have that 80% spending mandate that has to be there.
That's right. Yeah, because currently as much as 30-40% of your premium dollar goes into things like advertising or executive bonuses or hiring a whole bunch of people to figure out a way to get somebody else to pay the bill. That's, in effect, what happens with our private insurance market today.
But isn't that exactly what's happened to insurance? They've figured out, and it's a great thing if you can get it. It's a great gig if you can get it, by being able to cherry-pick the healthiest people and taking the sick people and the old people and the children and saying, you, government, you take care of these folks.
That's right. And that's the thing about it that is such a shame. You know, the health insurance industry is doing extremely well. As a friend of mine said, he said, if the Affordable Care Act passes, you better run. Don't walk. Run to your stockbroker and buy stock in health insurance companies, because they figured out a way to make a maximum profit while not providing the services that they should provide to their beneficiaries.
Yeah, last question I've got for you. You know, all this talk about socialism and all, it's a government takeover and it's this grand conspiracy and, you know, Obama's a socialist. I got to be honest. You know, when I was a kid, it was government health care that saved my life.
Yeah.
I'm not so concerned of, of who's paying the bill as long as my doctor is concerned about me.
That's absolutely right. You know, the irony of all of this talk about socialized medicine is that there is, in fact, socialized medicine in the United States, and both sides of the aisle support it. It's called the Veterans Administration healthcare system. It's a closed system. Doctors are salaried. Nobody makes a profit. But that's the only example of socialized medicine in the United States. The Affordable Care Act is far from that. What it does is it provides incentives and other kinds of tax credits and opportunities for people to purchase insurance. As I said before, nobody's happier about this law than the private health insurance industry.
Brian Smedley, I appreciate your time. Vice President and Director of the Health Policy Institute at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well?
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make this thing happen!
Your common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm sitting here with Ron Pollack, founding executive director of Families USA. Ron, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
Congratulations on the very nice words the president had to say about you earlier today at, before he gave his speech here at the conference.
Well, we are so delighted to have the opportunity to work with a president who really cares about making sure all Americans have high-quality, affordable health care. It's a real privilege.
Let's talk about Families USA. For our listeners, exactly what is it you guys do?
Families USA was created about three decades ago for the purpose of providing high-quality, affordable health care and coverage for everybody. And so we've worked hard to try and make sure health reform would be high on the national agenda. We worked hard together with the White House to make sure that good legislation would be passed. And now what we're doing is we're trying to make sure that state by state this gets implemented well and that nobody ever takes away the incredible benefits and rights that have been won through the Affordable Care Act.
You know, when you look at what happened here recently with the Republicans and their political theater game that they played trying to repeal this bill, it's got to be angering on one front. But on the other, you've got to be kind of happy to know that the polls are showing that people are more in favor every day of this bill.
I think we're going to see that's going to keep on happening. You know, there were so many myths about this legislation, you know, death panels, government takeover, and of course these things are nonsense. Now people are starting to get some of the benefits from this legislation. Most of the things actually go into effect a little down the road.
2014. Sure.
2014. But there are a number of things that are already going into effect. Young adults are getting coverage through their parents' policies. Children are no longer denied health care as or coverage from an insurance company just because they have a pre-existing condition. Seniors who have big gaps in their prescription drug coverage, they're now getting some help. Ultimately, that big gap is going to be eliminated, yes. And now you have certain rights. When the insurance company decides to terminate your policy because you got sick, or they have a lifetime cap, so if you made major illness, you have to pay out of pocket and you go into bankruptcy. Those things now are fixed. And as more and more people feel those things, I think they're learning about the wisdom of this legislation having been passed. And I think we're going to continue to see incremental increased support for this legislation.
Well, what do you say to someone like me, for instance, who was all in favor of a Medicare for all, perhaps a single-payer system? This, to me, falls short of what my goals were. What do you say to someone like me who says, you know, maybe this is it's a good start, but this isn't the end of the road?
Well, it isn't the end of the road. Let's be clear about that. I want to just give you an example of some other legislation that all of us cherish. The Social Security Act of 1935, many of us think, was one of the finest pieces of legislation in our country. When that legislation passed in 1935, it didn't cover half the women in the workforce.
Right.
It didn't cover two-thirds of the people of color in the workforce. And we fixed that over time. And so this is not perfect legislation. And those of us who care to have a good health care system, we're not going to rest on our laurels. But this creates a foundation. This creates a base. Had we failed to pass this legislation, I think we would be numerous decades
down the road, sure.
And we'd still have 50 million or more people without health insurance. That's unconscionable.
I absolutely agree. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Ron Pollack, founding executive director of Families USA. You know, and I look at this, and kind of in the same vein, I understand the historic magnitude of this, which is enormous. I mean, 100 years we've been trying to get something passed. What concerned me when the law passed is a lot of my friends who were fighting to get it passed said, we won, that's it. Closed up shop, went home. So, you know, I'm glad to see that there are groups out there who are fighting into the future, because the real fights are at the state levels with these state exchanges. And I've been using this for the last 2 days. The state of Pennsylvania, where we're from, the governor is one of the 20 that signed on as attorney general to have the law ruled unconstitutional. Yet now as governor, he's going to be in charge of setting up this exchange. That's an interesting situation and one that has to be concerning.
Well, you're saying something that's very important. The key fights now is to make sure this law gets implemented well. You know, it's one thing to have a law in the books. It's another thing for people actually to gain the benefits of it. And so the work that now needs to take place, state after state, is we've got to make sure that this law actually reaches the people in the way it was intended. And we have another battle, and that is we've got to make sure that those who want to destroy this legislation, who want to repeal this legislation, we can't allow them to take us backwards. And so we've got a lot of work to do. And I know this legislative battle took a long, long time, and some people have health reform fatigue. But we can't afford to have it, because the opponents, they don't have fatigue. They're going after this legislation.
And they're well-funded.
And they're well-funded, and we've got implementation to do. So we can't rest on our laurels.
You know, one of the things that concerns me about the plan is that quite easily, I think the Republicans or people who want to see it destroyed can just cut off funding to it, and it will be another one of those programs that people point to as, you know, government tried and they failed. Much like, you know, the situations we're seeing with pensions across the country. They defunded it, they starved it, and now they're saying, look, the crisis that we created, look at it.
Yeah, well, one of the things, keep in mind, most of the funding for this new legislation was contained in that legislation. And therefore, you don't have to go back to the appropriations process for that. Now, there are some things that you have to go to the appropriations process. And those are, you know, that's where the issues you're raising are significant. But the overwhelming majority of the resources needed to implement this legislation is already passed into law. And we do not have to go through the appropriations
really?
Process.
Because, you know, as the states have to put this, that's interesting that you say that, because as the states set up these exchanges, the money's already appropriated. Because, you know, I'm looking at a state like Pennsylvania, like New Jersey, they've got massive budget deficits. And I see this as another one of those things where they go, we just can't afford it. Like the hell, like the unemployment debate. They were saying we can't afford to extend unemployment to folks. That's one of my concerns. On the state level, you're going to have these governors like Christie, like Corbett, saying we just can't afford it.
Well, so let's go through these exchanges. People who get into the exchange who have income, say, for a family of four below $88,200, that's the level, they're going to get tax credit subsidies. That's what's going to make coverage affordable, to help them pay for the premiums. We do not have to go back to Congress to get that money. So for every person who qualifies, there is now a guarantee that that will be funded. Also, there are some improvements for the poorest of the poor, the expansion of the Medicaid program. From 2014 through 2016, all of that expansion, those people who come in who are newly eligible, 100% paid for by the federal government. That's fully paid for.
For those 2 years, right.
3 years, 2014,
right.
2015,
okay.
2016. Thereafter, the states are going to have to pick up a little portion of it. Federal government picks up 97 and 95. It never goes below 90%. States never have to pay more than 10 cents out of the dollar for the new people who are eligible. All those federal funds are guaranteed in the statute.
Well, that's terrific, and that's something I did not know. And it'll be very useful as we move back and begin this discussion, because some of the things we're already hearing, some of the rumblings I'm already hearing about the exchanges, it's just going to be too costly, and it's going to end up being where everybody goes.
Well, middle-class families that increasingly are having a tough time affording insurance, they are now going to have an opportunity, if they don't have coverage through the workplace, they're going to be able to go to the exchange. And if they've got this income that puts them in the middle class, they're going to get these tax credit subsidies. And that's paid for without state money.
Excellent. You know, let's come back to the conference here today. Yesterday, today, you've had this wonderful event. What are your hopes going out of this? You know, I understand it was kind of a celebration that the bill was passed, kind of, you know, doing the whole pat on the back. Now where do we go from here? What are you hoping that people will do when they leave here?
Well, our celebration has already taken place. Now we got some hard work to do. And the hard work means state after state, we got to get this implemented right. Now, let me give you an example. People are now newly eligible if they're poor in the Medicaid program. People are newly eligible to get coverage with tax credit subsidies if they're middle class. Well, what does it take for those people to apply? Do they have to take a day off from work in order to apply? That doesn't work. So we got to get rules to make sure that doesn't happen. The application should be simple. They should be in multiple languages if somebody's main language is not English. They should be able to apply at a hospital, at a pharmacy, at a library, at a community health center. Those are the kinds of details that now have to be worked out. And, by the way, somebody shouldn't have to go down to the Medicaid office and to the exchange because they don't know what they're eligible for. There should be one application. And if your income changes and you're eligible for one program later in the year, another program, there should be a seamless process.
Right.
Those are the kinds of details we've got to work on. And those are those details that will make this work. And so that's our job.
And from what I've seen here, the people that I've met, I'm confident that we will break out of this conference and get some of that work done, thanks to you.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Ron Pollack, Founding Executive Director of Families USA, I appreciate your time, and thank you so much for having us.
And I appreciate what you do. Thanks.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It just gives me more energy to continue doing my job.
United Steelworkers Subdistrict Director Manny Armenta, freed after being arrested this week in Mexico while on his way to meet with lawyers for the Los Mineros Mexican Miners Union. He was arrested supposedly for driving a stolen car, but the car was leased to the union. After having the car impounded and being held in a cell for several hours, he was free, but $700 in cash was stolen from his wallet. The USW is filing a formal protest over the arrest with the U.S. State Department. Armenta and the USW are working to support Los Mineros. Mexican miners are waging a nearly four-year strike with giant mining company Grupo Mexico. Armenta says the workers have suffered violent suppression from the company and the Mexican government.
There's been fatalities. There's been a lot of tear gas in some of the places they try to organize, and even in the places they're already organized and represent the workers. This week is just an indication of how corrupt the Mexican government is, along with the company, the Grupo Mexico, a very powerful company, and they obviously control a lot of the government officials.
The USW is determined to continue to stand in solidarity with Los Mineros. The AFL-CIO and the International Association of Machinists are suing South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley for saying that the state will try to keep unions out of a new Boeing plant in Charleston. The suit in U.S. District Court seeks a court order telling the governor and her director of the South Carolina Department of Labor, Licensing and Regulation to remain neutral when it comes to union activities. Dubai is a city defined by its expensive living and eclectic ambition, but it isn't as well known for its willingness to let worker abuses slide. Jesse Russell reports.
Construction workers in Dubai received a reminder about the lack of labor rights in the United Arab Emirates this week. An estimated 5,000 Arab tech construction workers went on strike in mid-January to demand a pay increase that would amount to $54 extra per month. Construction workers in Dubai, who are typically brought in from South Asia, earn on average the equivalent of $190 to $220 per month. Arabtech Holding is the largest construction company in Dubai, and the workers are used for everything from building the skyscrapers that are increasingly springing up on the city's skyline to hotels. Public labor unrest is a rarity in the Emirates because workers often fear they'll be deported or arrested. In this case, 50 of the workers who went on strike are being sent packing due to their willingness to demand better wages in a country that has become known for its rampant excess.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. Work is so hard to
make it easy. Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Health Conference. I'm sitting here with Karen Maples. She's the founder and president of MyUtique LLC. It's an innovative strategies company that helps clients ignite significant growth through implementation of bold ideas. And I guess the bold idea, Karen, is this healthcare bill. This change is an opportunity for people to start new businesses, have new ideas.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we have not been talking about enough with healthcare reform is the fact that this is going to create a fairly significant disruption in the healthcare market as we know it today. And so for tuned-in entrepreneurs and for smart business executives and CEOs, there's tremendous opportunities that we need to start thinking about because we've got new ways that we can grow our businesses. So let me give you an example. If you think about the fact that we're going to have 27 to 30 million new people participating in the healthcare market,
right,
that in and of itself is huge. That's a huge market opportunity. Along with that, current healthcare providers have not ever had a need to be consumer-centric or consumer-friendly. And now that we we're going to have this huge consumer participation in the healthcare market, the market itself is going to have to become more consumer friendly. And if the existing healthcare providers don't do that themselves, they're going to be new players rushing in because they're going to understand what you do to market and sell to consumers and to provide them with the with a better healthcare plan.
Right. That's interesting because, you know, most of what I'm being told is a lot of fear, is a lot of, you know, we're afraid of this change. You know, everything that we have is going to be destroyed, and we're told that we have the best delivery healthcare system in the world. And I tend to agree if you can afford it. We do have the best system in the world right now. But, you know, as this changes, I do see there being opportunities to improve on things and improve on delivery and on quality as well. A couple of specifics if you have, because, you know, I think about my grandmother who uses a significant amount of health care. There are so many opportunities to help her streamline her care that I'm amazed that, A, we haven't done it already, and B, why I'm not demanding more of someone taking kind of a more strategic approach to her health care.
Absolutely. And when you talk about we have the best health care in the world, that also is a myth. We spend over $7,000 per person for health care in comparison with other advanced countries where the price is about $3,000 per person. That's a $4,000 gap. When you look at life expectancy and infant mortality, we actually lag. So we're not getting the benefit for our health care dollars. Right. We're not being smart about how we're spending.
On
exactly.
Average. You know, which is why I added the caveat, if you can afford it. I do believe we have the best technology and probably the best doctors if you can afford it. If you can reach into your pocket and pay cash out of your pocket because you see foreign dignitaries, you see oil sheiks coming here to the U.S. to have procedures done. Why? Because they can afford the best of everything. That you and I, the average working people, we don't necessarily get that treatment.
Absolutely. And one of the things that is in the health care reform bill is specific, there are specific passages that talk about bending the healthcare cost curve. So there's already attention being paid to that. Because what we need to do is we need to make it more affordable overall. But in order for every American to have the opportunity to have good healthcare, we need to have participation, broad participation.
Absolutely.
Because that's what will help premiums come down.
Which is why I'm a big fan of personal responsibility and a big fan of the mandate. I think you have to have a buy-in by everybody, because if you have free riders who are going to cheat the system, it's going to destroy the system.
Absolutely. And going back to the cost issue, one of the other things that's in the bill that's going to create opportunity is the move toward electronic healthcare records, because we need to look at things we can do
right
to make the system more efficient. Well, today, only 6% of office-based physicians have any form of electronic medical record systems. That means that 94% of office-based physicians are going to need assistance in getting their offices up to speed. That is a tremendous opportunity. And then when we talk about bold ideas, I think if we put out there and have our brightest minds thinking about what do we do to rein in healthcare costs while we're still providing high quality service, but also making sure that we're making it more broadly accessible, that big idea is going to bring the entrepreneurial spirit in, if you will.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, and looking at this, you know, I don't, and this is where I'm going to take a Republican frame. It's not a spending problem. I mean, it's not a revenue problem, it's a spending problem. We've got tons of money going into healthcare. It's just that we're not allocating it, in my opinion, properly. I think we have way too much that goes into shareholders, into the corporate model and people taking out of healthcare than we have actually providing services and helping create jobs and workers.
And there's not enough attention being focused on, you know, where are the benchmarks for places in the world or even places within the United States where health care is being provided in a more affordable way and actually resulting in better
practices? Sure.
Exactly. Those are the other kinds of things that are going to start happening as we move past the debate about should we or should we not embrace health care reform. Now we need to embrace opportunity,
yep,
and as a country all rally behind what are the specific things we can do to make this system work better, be more affordable, rein in health care costs, and also unleash the opportunity for people like your grandmother to be to have access to the same kind of treatment that an oil executive has.
Yeah, you see, I've taken a different approach to this entrepreneurial idea. That I've said that, you know, the opportunity to rekindle the American spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit that this country's been famous for, is take healthcare off the backs of people so they will go out and they will start their business. I've got a friend who drives a truck for a living. Why? Because he gets insurance from that. He would love to go out and be a contractor. He can't make that step but you're taking this from a different point of view. The entrepreneurial spirit of changing our system and making it better. And I think there's a very real opportunity there. So in your business of MyUtique LLC, as you're the president and founder of, what suggestions would you give to a client? And I don't want you to give out your trade secrets free, but you know, what kind of things would you be suggesting?
Well, first of all, I think it's important for entrepreneurs and business owners and CEOs of companies to be thinking about paying attention to what's happening in the healthcare marketplace and then comparing that with the current skill sets and capabilities they have today. So there are opportunities for IT companies who may not be currently playing in the healthcare space. Anyone who's in consumer packaged goods has skill sets that insurance providers are going to need. So I'm just giving you a couple of examples.
Sure.
So you look at your own core competencies as a business and also look at the trends in terms of what's happening around you and then being very smart about where there's an opportunity for you to start making a play. And it doesn't mean that this is going to happen for a company in a week or a month. It's more of a strategic opportunity, but now is the time to get involved.
Sure.
And to start identifying where there's a good match for your company's skill sets with the needs and requirements as we move forward with healthcare reform.
You talk about the IT sector, and I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of all the centralization of records. I know it's coming, and I'm pretty sure that ship has already sailed, that we're probably heading towards electronic records. Because I got to be honest, I'm a little leery of having everything right there for one easy. You know, they hack into banker and government offices all the time.
Rick, you're making a very important point because security of healthcare records is going to be an absolute requirement, and that means that taking care of security, thinking about cybersecurity, and new software that can make sure that we have super protection of records is going to be necessary before we can really move forward as fast as we want to with the centralization of records. Because we cannot afford for people's private medical records to get unleashed in the public space. And so before electronic health records become kind of this, you know, super centralized database in the sky, we've got to make sure that we have unbreakable security and focusing on cybersecurity here.
Yeah.
And that also creates
another
an opportunity.
Sure. In this bill, in the Affordable Care Act, are there any helps for business to start some of this thing? Are there ways that government could help entrepreneurs look, you know, start beginning to do some of the innovations that you've talked about?
Well, there are R&D tax credits R&D tax credits for people or companies who are pursuing new advances, but not just in the bill. The other thing that's happening that people may not be aware of is companies like GE, and GE is only one, are actually creating funds, R&D funds, to solicit innovation ideas about how we can bend the healthcare cost curve. So the other thing that is important for entrepreneurs to be doing is looking to companies like General Electric, any of the current providers. Pfizer's another company that's doing a lot to be innovative in the way they're working with the consumer market. So tune in to what companies like GE and Pfizer are doing to embrace our innovation ideas. And that's another opportunity for a company to get involved and get funding without actually relying on what's specifically in the bill itself.
So it will be interesting to see how things play out over the next several years, because this is going to happen. And there are going to be 50 little laboratories all around this country, because each state is going to do something a little bit different. And I would guess you would have to advise, you know, clients based on state to state kind of requirements. Kind of look at Pennsylvania. The guy who's going to be in charge of setting up our exchange is a guy who's against it. Signed on to the lawsuit to have it thrown out, yet he's going to be the guy in charge of setting it up. So that should be interesting to see. But it does offer some opportunities there.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we want to do, and this is not necessarily in the bill itself, this is one of the things that I think will be important, is for us to be monitoring what's happening in each state so that we can identify the best practices and who's really succeeding in addressing the challenges, and then make sure that that information gets shared broadly so that as some states are successful, other states can learn and hopefully,
you learn from the other people's failures.
Well, and hopefully we'll learn from people's successes as well.
Because I'm a firm believer of you learn from your failures and your mistakes much more than you learn from your successes.
Absolutely.
Karen Maples, I appreciate your time. Founder and president of MyUtique LLC. My website, MyUtique.
www.myutique.com.
And we'll make sure you get a link at our site at therickmithshow.com. Karen, thank you so much. Great talking to you.
Thank you, Rick, for having me.
All righty, we're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Isn't it nice to know that whenever America faces a big issue, Americans can always count on Congress to be there. For themselves, that is. Take health care. Corporate-funded front groups churned out a mess of lies to foment public opposition to Obama's rather modest insurance reform, demonizing it as a government takeover of our health care system. It was no such thing, but that hasn't stopped Republican lawmakers from making a theatrical show of trying to repeal Obama's reform and, quote, save the people from the horrors of socialized medicine. Yet, in all their blathering, none of them have offered to save themselves from the horror of taxpayer-provided health care. Congress critters get Cadillac coverage at our expense. Plus, they have their own in-house bevy of government doctors to attend to them. Why don't they vote to eliminate this privileged bastion of socialism? Then there's the real horror of gun violence that exploded most recently in Arizona. In response, members of Congress rushed forward with creative solutions. It's all about public safety, they exclaimed, by which they meant saving themselves from the public. Representative Peter King showed what he's made of by introducing legislation making it a federal crime to carry a gun within the vicinity of a congressperson. Representative Dan Burton proposed an emergency job creation program, which would consist of immediately sealing off the House gallery with bulletproof glass to shield the skittish Solons from the people. And a couple of members took a bold stand for individual responsibility by announcing that they would henceforth show their respect for constituents by packing pistols when going out amongst them. This is Jim Hightower saying, good grief! Don't they do enough damage by shooting off their mouths? I don't know about you, but I don't think Congress people should be trusted with real guns.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds like a don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around, waiting for a don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Who are people gonna rise up, get their share,
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm sitting here with Jeff List. He's a partner with the Anzol Research Group. Jeff, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this conference and everything that went into getting to this point where we have a law now on the books for healthcare, and I think about the messaging that we lost right from the beginning. I think the Democrats lost the messaging almost right from the start. And the president in the State of the Union, I think, did a little bit to pull it back. Repealing it will cost us $250 billion. We could lose upwards of 400,000 jobs. Yet people are still asking, how do we reframe this discussion? I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, I think that reframing the discussion gets a lot easier now that the Republicans are trying to repeal a law that's already in place. Now it's about what they're trying to take away from people that people already have. You know, Republicans want to take away your protections against being denied coverage if you've got a pre-existing condition. They want to take away your protections against being dropped by your insurance company if you get sick. They want to take away your right as a young person to stay on your parents' insurance until you turn 26 years old. And these are all things that Republicans want to take away from people, and they want to do it because they're doing the bidding of insurance companies and not of middle-class families.
You know, I think Wendell Potter was right. I mean, somehow we got beat up on the messaging, which was all about fear. I don't want to be that the other side of that, fear, scaring people into believing, well, oh, the end of the world's going to happen. I want this to be the right thing. We're doing it because it is the right thing to do.
Well, look, we fought hard to get these things for people, and we shouldn't give them back. I mean, the vast majority of American families work hard. They do their part. They pay their insurance premiums. They shouldn't get dropped if they get sick. You know, these are not gifts that have been given to the American people. These are things that they've earned, you know, and they deserve to keep them. You know, I understand your concerns with wanting to do this the right way. I also think, though, that to some extent, turnabout is fair play, and I'm not going to weep too many crocodile tears over the Republicans, you know, because also they beat us over the head with this idea that we should be focusing on jobs and not on health care reform. And at this point, I think that we could make the same argument, and I think that we could make it in good faith, because what they're doing is all kabuki theater. They know they're not going to repeal health care reform.
And we wasted a bunch of money in a couple of days where we could have been working on something else just for, as you said, this kabuki theater that they've put out. But it is about pandering. And one of the things I've always said is Republicans are very good at sloganeering. They're very good at campaigning. And that's what that was. That was campaigning. That wasn't governing.
Well, I think it's also easier to it's easier to deliver a message if you're not particularly interested in intellectual honesty or consistency.
There is that, and the next day they came up with, now let's start talking about what we want to do. Well, you ran on repealing it. Didn't you have an idea all the way up into this? I mean, they're what they told us they were looking for was common sense. We're going to repeal it and replace it with common sense. And when I'm laying on the ground having a heart attack, I'm sure glad that I've got common sense in my wallet.
Well, I don't even know that to this point, to this day, they've got any good idea of what they would replace this with. You know, they're clearly not interested in the budget deficit, because they know that repealing health care reform would add billions, hundreds of billions of dollars to our budget deficit over the next 10 years. They pay a little bit of lip service to wanting to keep these protections against being denied coverage based on pre-existing conditions, but at the same time, they're making this totally intellectually dishonest argument about the mandate, knowing that that the two things are not separable.
Let's talk about your expertise. You're a partner of Anzalone Research, anzaloneresearch.com. You know, we keep hearing all of this discussion that the American people have spoken and they want to repeal this health care bill. It's all I heard the Republicans talking about. We've got this mandate, the American people have spoken. In your experience, is it as loud as they're claiming?
No, that's a completely incorrect statement. If you look at what's happened in terms of overall support for the bill, it's been getting consistently better. And in the last AP poll a couple of weeks ago, voters were basically split evenly with 40% against the law and 41% in favor of the law. If you look at the Gallup poll on repeal, you know, by a 6-point margin, voters favor repeal, but it's still, you know, way fewer than half. It's not like there's a, you know, a 2-thirds majority out there that wants this bill repealed. And the truth is that even among people who, some of the people who want it repealed, they want it to go further. They want it to do more. So even that number can be a misleading
number. I don't want it repealed, but I do want it to go further. And I think most people that I know want it to go further. I'm a big supporter of a single payer system. Would have been happier with a public option. This, to me, is a starting point. I hope this isn't the end of it, though.
Oh, I agree with that. I think that covering 30 million Americans and doing it in a way that actually reduces our deficit over the next 10 years is a pretty good start. But I think it's also important to remember that the vast majority of Americans already have health insurance. They're pretty happy with what they've got. What they're not happy with is that their rates keep going up every year. And I think that we need to continue to do more to make sure that we lower rates for middle-class families who are already struggling in a bad economy.
Yeah, I look at myself. We pay somewhere over $14,000 a year for health care coverage. We're happy with it, but I know in 10 years I'm not going to be able to afford $25,000 for that.
That's right. Well, you know, as an incidental part of being a pollster, I'm also a small business owner, and I can tell you that a lot of the things that are in the Affordable Care Act to help small businesses are going to be good for us. You know, not only are we going to give them tax credits to help offer health insurance coverage to their employees, but we're going to let small businesses pool together in order to get lower rates the same as big companies get. And I think that in the long run, that's going to be good for a lot of people who work for small businesses.
Yeah, I agree. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Jeff List. He's a partner of Anzalone Research, AnzaloneResearch.com. You know, one of the things right from the beginning that, again, I thought was a messaging nightmare, Speaker Pelosi came out and said, the more people learn about it, the more they're going to love it. I thought that was a bit backwards. I thought the education process should have started so people learned about it up front. This way they didn't have to wait down the road and have that messaging nightmare that it turned out to be.
Well, I think there were some structural problems in the messaging. I think that if you look back to the mid-90s and the Clinton effort to pass health care reform, one of the complaints was that too much was dictated to Congress. Congress didn't have enough say in producing a bill. There was a revolution in Congress. Our problems were bipartisan in Congress. We ended up not getting anything done. We took a very different approach legislatively this time. Unfortunately, that meant that there was no one health care bill, and in a lot of ways that made it harder for us to get one consistent message, whereas the Republicans, you know, could all be in lockstep just as the party of no. So I think that, again, that created some structural problems, but at the end of the day, we got a bill passed that's going to cover 30 million Americans, that's going to let kids stay on their parents' health insurance till they're 26, that's going to protect you if you've got a pre-existing condition, you know, that does a lot of good stuff that makes a pretty good start for us. I agree that we had some messaging challenges. I think the messaging challenges are going away to some extent, you know, now that the sort of math is flipped and it's all about repeal versus keeping these benefits that we've given people.
Right. You know, and talking about what you were just talking about there with the Clinton bill, do you think that's the reason that the Democrats didn't do that again, that they kind of did this whole reaching across the aisle, pretty much really stall and delay process? I look in Pennsylvania. I don't know if you saw the big blowout that happened in Pennsylvania on Wednesday with the state legislature, but the Republicans are going to, they're going to march right down the road. There will be no asking the minority party for anything. They're going to walk right down the, they're going to privatize the state stores. They're going to go full steam with the vouchers. I'm sure Pennsylvania is going to be a right-to-work state before long. They're not going to ask for any minority help. So do you think maybe that was a mistake by the Democrats early on? Or
well, I don't know that the Republicans in Pennsylvania promised that they were going to be bipartisan consensus builders in the way that the president did in the 2008 campaign. I mean, I think that you could probably make an argument that after all of the Republicans voted against the stimulus, which was, you know, all capital letters, the bill to save the economy, that we probably should have recognized that they were going to go scorched earth on everything. Still, I don't think that it was the wrong thing to do to look for bipartisan solutions, especially since the substance of the bill was so moderate. I think it's unfortunate that it's gotten such bad branding when, in fact, you know, a lot of it looks like the Republican alternative from the mid-90s to the Clinton proposal.
That's the thing that gets me. I mean, most of the ideas that are in this, most of it were their ideas. So how can you then go and be against it?
Well, for purely partisan reasons, and purely partisan reasons sauced with a complete indifference to the welfare of middle-class families.
And in your polling, does any of that come up? I mean, do people realize that, I mean, is there any cognizant reality there that, you know, this is how it was?
People don't realize, for one thing, that every Republican voted against the health care bill. I don't think there's general awareness of the degree to which they've gone scorched earth on the president's policies.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I find really disturbing, that our media structure in this country has done such a poor job of informing the electorate, or that we're maybe that lazy.
That's true, but also, I mean, in terms of the substance, part of the problem that the Democrats ran into was that the Republican messaging was going to be what it was going to be, irrespective of the of the content of the bill. You know, we chased bipartisanship for the better part of a year, and in the end, their message was they rammed it down our throats.
You know? This whole thing is going to move now from the federal level to each of the states. Each state is now mandated to set up an exchange, correct?
That's correct. You're going to see a lot of the battle now moving to implementation state by state, which is going to be trench warfare, as you know, it requires involvement by a lot of state legislatures.
Especially given the fact that the last report I saw, $125 billion deficit among the 50 states. The Republicans have said no help for the states. So all the states, Pennsylvania, $5 billion shortfall in their budget. How is that going to play when you're looking at all of the problems that the states are having?
Well, I think you're seeing right now a lot of Republican governors using the state budget crises as an excuse to do away with a lot of things that they don't like and to balance budgets on the backs of a lot of their most vulnerable populations and, you know, in cases like New Jersey, on the backs of their teachers.
Pennsylvania, it's going to be the same thing in Pennsylvania because we get Governor Corbett looks up to Christie.
Right.
As insane as Christie has been, this is the idol of the guy that we've just elected.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think it's a huge problem. At the same time, it's more important than ever, you know, that this safety net not fall away from middle class families, because there just isn't a lot of job security out there. If you lose your job, chances are the job that you get isn't one that offers you benefits that are as good as what you've had. But it becomes more and more important that the fight not be given up at the state level, that we don't view this as a battle that's already been won, and that advocates at the state level fight hard in order to get this thing implemented right.
An excellent point, because most of the people that I've talked to, you know, right after President Obama was elected, most of the Organizing for America people disappeared. After this health care bill was passed, most of the advocacy groups that wanted to get it passed disappeared. So it seemed you had this build up to the passage. Okay, we're done now. We can go home.
Mm-hmm.
And we're right where we are. When I would say that's when the fight just began.
It's hard to keep fighting as hard as people were in the lead up to the 2008 elections. I think that I think we probably could have done a better job of keeping people engaged in what these laws mean for them at a practical level, and in fighting for them at a grassroots level. But at the same time, people's lives are hard. They're struggling in a bad economy. Yep. You know, it's hard to blame people for not being able to maintain the level of sort of frenzied activism that preceded the 2008 elections.
But I go back to this, and in kind of the last little series I have for you, going back to the states, the states are in trouble. And implementing this on a, here, we're going to let you do this, I think is troublesome.
Mm-hmm.
I look at Pennsylvania. We got our governor is a guy who was one of the attorney generals who said we're gonna file a lawsuit to rule this unconstitutional. Yet he's in charge of being the guy having to set it up in the state. There's a real problem there.
Sure. I mean, what do you do in a state like Virginia, where the attorney general is leading the pro repeal movement? I think that a bigger problem, and one that may be hidden from a lot of people, is that a lot of the bureaucrats who are in charge of implementation are going to be appointed by a lot of these governors who don't have any interest in seeing the law succeed, and who may in fact be served by it not working particularly well for the people of their individual states. I think that, again, there's no solution to this other than people demanding accountability on a state by state level and
being
holding
informed
these
about it. Because I look at Christie in New Jersey, for instance, and I go back to the Christie Todd Whitman era where they didn't fund the pension funds. I look at Pennsylvania. Tom Ridge didn't fund the pension funds for years. I guess Christie just put off another payment that they decided not to make. So they're creating these massive crises and saying, look, government doesn't work. So again, you go back to this exchange thing. The people who have put us in the crisis that we're in, we're going to ask them to set up what's hopefully going to be in our best interest in the future. To me, very concerning.
It's a disaster, and New Jersey and Pennsylvania are great examples of that. In the 1990s, Republicans ran those states to fiscal ruination, in terms of the debt, in terms of the unfunded pension liabilities. You know, it's left people with tax burdens that are much higher than, sort of the value of the services that they're getting. And so Republicans get in some ways to have their cake and eat it too.
Because nobody's holding them accountable.
They demonstrate that government doesn't work, and then they argue that government doesn't work, and then they demonstrate that government government doesn't work.
And what it always got me, you know, Bush ran on a platform of, I don't believe in government. We have candidates running on the platform. I don't believe in it. Did they get elected? If I went for a job and said, you know, I don't believe in polls, would you hire me?
Probably not. But the good news is that the American people tend to have a more expansive view of the role of government than they get credit for. Right. And I think that although the American people generally prefer private market solutions to things, just as sort of an orthodoxy, they still believe the government has a role in fixing a lot of these problems. Dan Ariely has done a lot of good research on that. And the Republicans, just as the Democrats were, are going to be punished if they don't make government work for people.
Good point. Jeff List, partner in Anzalone Research Company, anzaloneresearch.com. We'll put a link at our site, therickSmithShow.com. Jeff, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick.
All righty, we're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Go on, take the money and run. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. We are here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting here with Dr. Carol Scott, radio personality, stress guru, bunch of websites, OptimalStress.com, the main one, StressReliefRadio.com, her radio website. Dr. Scott, thank you for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Stress seems to be the key factor in both your websites, kind of, I guess, the focus of your career?
Absolutely. I'm a practicing emergency physician, and you know how sometimes things just get to be too much for you and you can't take it anymore?
Do I?
That happened to me several years ago, and I determined that instead of waiting for patients to come into the emergency department, along with my own crisis, I decided that I needed to learn more about stress, what it really was, how does it affect you. And now I find that I take messages from the bedside in the emergency department, where I still practice emergency medicine, but I take it now to boardrooms, to stages around the country to help people understand what stress is and that stress can kill you. You know, we're here at this health conference this week, and the truth is 70 to 80% of all medical conditions that patients present to primary care doctors or emergency departments for are related to stress. Stress kills.
Yeah, we absolutely live very stressful lives. And you look at a place like here in Washington, D.C., the president's coming to speak here at this conference, and I can't imagine a guy with more stress than him giving the tone of the discussion here in this town sometimes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it affects just everyday people. It affects you and it affects me. You know, I'm a wife, a mom, I have two boys, and life can be very complicated when you're trying to do it all. And right now I'm seeing with my clients and also in the emergency department, people are really pushed to the limit. You know, if you have a job, you're happy to have that job.
Yep.
You're not going to push back. You're going to do whatever you're asked to do. But then you feel badly about it. In fact, I had a woman who came into the emergency department the other day, and she had chest pain. And when she came in, this is a lady who was in her 40s, hardworking lady, who said that they had had a cutback, so she had to take on new responsibilities, but they didn't give her the training to be able to do what she was being asked to do. So then her boss was getting upset with her. She was getting bad feedback. She'd been in this job long enough that she wants to keep it. She needs it. Then some family members got ill in her family. She's having to pay some bills. People are trying to move in and stay with her because she's got relatives who are not able to make it along. And now, and this woman ended up flat on her back in my emergency department with chest pain.
Now, I can see how that happens. You know, the more complicated our lives get, the more we take on, the more I can see how it piles up on you.
Absolutely.
And given the, you know, the state of this recession, given the state of health care and the such, I can absolutely see how stress could kill you.
And my position is, particularly in the context of this meeting that we're here for now, is that we need to be thinking about looking specifically at stress as prevention. And we need to think about stress not just as something that's a consequence of our actions, but we need to think about it as a cause.
Right. Well, how do we do that?
Well, I think everybody has the onus to take personal responsibility for it, to think about it. Now, having said that, that's like blaming the victim, right?
I think I got a thousand things running through my head right now going, yeah, I take responsibility for myself, but, you know, I've still got a wife and three kids and a job and car payments and
all those things that weigh on your mind that really
are kind of out of your control, so to speak.
Well, and that's key, what you said, out of your control, Rick, because the key is, that's one key, is to determine what are those things that you can control and those that you can't. You know how relieving it is sometimes just to recognize that something that you've been worrying about or really stressing about or, you know, you're just obsessing about it and you can't figure out what to do about it, and you land in your bed or you're in the shower one day and suddenly it strikes you, wait a second. You know, this is something that I can just let go. Now, not everything is that way. You know, you got to have the job. You got to have the money coming in. You have to meet certain responsibilities as a grown-up, as it were. But in general, I think oftentimes we take on things that we don't need to. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have three kids. How old are your kids?
4, 8, and 2.
Oh, my God. You do have little kids. But let's look at it this way. Your 8-year-old. Every once in a while, your 8-year-old will ask you to do something, and they want permission for something to do, or they want to be at a friend's house, have a play date. Now we're not talking about being a tiger mom. That's a whole other conversation, right? But tiger mom or dad. But let's just say that you have a difference of opinion. that can stress you out. If you constantly get to the point that, right. But I would say to you that if you really think in your heart of hearts what you want for your 8-year-old and your 4-year-old and your 2-year-old is you want their safety. The 2-year-old, the 4-year-old, you have a little more control because you kind of set limits to, and they only can move when you move, so to speak. But your 8-year-old who's out there now, right, making some decisions on a day-to-day basis.
Scaring me to death.
Scaring you to death. The truth is, though, as long as you set up parameters, the other hog care. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, I tell my wife that all the time because my wife is really the controlling one. I'm more of, go ahead. Go do what you got to do. But she's really the protective one.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm of the mindset, let them climb on the furniture. They fall, they crack their head open.
Now, wait a second. I know. That's not
they learn that lesson.
Oh, come on
we all learn those lessons
somehow. Well, you do.
And the more you protect them early on so that they don't make those little mistakes, down the road, they make bigger ones.
Of you together do a good job of coping. Parenting.
No, my wife does a terrific job of pretty much single parenting because I work so much.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to talk about stress. That, absolutely, for me is an internal stressor because my daughter is, my 8-year-old is a guilt machine. Every time I leave the house, it's pack the bags, we're going on a guilt trip.
Okay, now I want you to let's just take time out with that because I think this is universal. It happens with so many of us. I think one of my sons got to the point that he knew when I was going to leave the house, he'd get my keys and he'd hide them. One time he put them in the ventilator system, down, and the keys were gone. They were missing.
Hope my kids aren't listening.
But I think it's really important for us for you and for me, to really look at why we're guilty, okay? Because all it's that make us king. I need to be at home, but the truth is, maybe for this particular point in time, you need to be away because you have to bring back that income. The key is, how do you communicate that with your 8-year-old?
Yeah.
And I know I didn't take the time sometimes to really sit down and have that conversation. Hey, Dad is doing this. Put something up on the refrigerator. Dad's working on this project. And kids, they don't see the future as forever. They see it as, till next week's,
ballet
lesson. Right. So what you can do is say, Dad is going to be away this day, put a color-coded calendar on the refrigerator. But by the time we get to this day, that's when Dad and you, we're going to have a special date. Are you with me on that?
Well, that's what I do. That's their Christmas present.
Oh.
I give them a calendar with events that we're going to do out through the year. This year we're doing hockey games for the next couple of months. The hockey season's over, and then baseball, and then
that is cool. That's cool. But guilt is a huge stress.
Oh, it is. Every day.
Irrational.
So how do we move to our discussion here of how that then?
Okay.
I do worry about that. One of these days, I'm gonna stress myself right into a heart attack.
Well, no, you're not.
Which is not funny, but
no.
Well, you never
first
know.
Go buy the book, right? Optimal Stress.
Optimal Stress.
Living in your best.
You can get that at optimalstress.com.
Right. Or you can get it on Amazon. It was published by Wiley last year, so it's available at Barnes & Noble. Or I think it's also on a Kindle version. But I think that the first thing is to rethink your definition of stress. Oftentimes, people think of stress as that external pressure, that thing that's inevitable, that thing that's on you. But the truth is, stress is not just a cause. Stress is also an effect. It's the response that you have to inevitable events in your life. So the real power in getting your head around and getting a handle on stress in your life is thinking about it as a process, as cause and effect. So right away you can see that there's things you can do. Some causes, you can avoid them, you can prevent them, you can reduce the intensity of the exposure to them. Now, another way to think about it is there are different types of triggers or causes. There are acute stressors, something that just disrupts your day. There are chronic ones, those are disparities. Okay, the difference between acute is a disruption, chronic is a disparity. A disparity is the difference between what you think you've earned or you should have and what you're experiencing. Then there are life events, right? Marriages, job losses, deaths. And then there are disasters, and they can be man-made or they can be natural, wars or tornadoes or hurricanes, something like that.
So or the snow that shut down Washington, D.C.
You got it. Wow. I didn't need to stretch ourselves to think about that.
Snow here every year.
Right. But there's value in thinking about those four different categories because there's something very different about how your body responds, okay, the biologic response, and also the emotional response, the psychological response, and the behavioral response. So let me put that all together again. So when you want to think about how to get a handle on stress in your life, I want you to think about stress as a process. It doesn't just happen. It's not an event. Okay? There has to be something that triggers this series of events that leads to responses. The triggers can be acute, chronic, disasters, or life events. The responses can be biological, behavioral, thoughts, or emotions. Emotions, we all know about that, anger, hostility. Your thoughts, you can ruminate about things. You can just kind of like spiral down, especially if you don't have the right people around you in your life and you need to talk to somebody.
Especially instead you don't let it out.
You go, and let it out with the right person. You don't let it out?
No, I'm the build, explode guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hey, we have to take a couple steps back, but that's okay. Yeah, after this, we'll have to talk about that. But and then the behavioral thing, I think, is that's what gets me, I'll tell you, because, you know, eating the wrong thing, staying up late, not getting your sleep the way that you should, and that is a vicious cycle because then, okay, we're talking about this meeting, we're talking about obesity, right?
Right.
I have some extra weight here, you know. I think half the people here, well, statistically, 60% of Americans are overweight. We think about the health care costs that are attributed to that. We think about the employer costs that are related to it. In fact, if you think about employer costs, there was a study that was published in the American Journal of Public Health a few years ago that described that of all the 10 modifiable healthcare lifestyle things that are going on that an employer could have as they manage their employees, stress increased healthcare costs by 46% because it was right. 40 more than diabetes, more than cardiovascular disease, which are things that we often think about as being real problems for healthcare and healthcare costs. And mind you, it's one thing that this cost is there for the employer, but it's there for you and me and human costs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? How you feel, what you do, what you cannot do. You speak of your 8-year-old. You want to be around when she's 18 for that prom, when she's 28 for that marriage, and you're walking her down the aisle. I see you smiling.
Right? Yeah, I'm hoping it'll be that long. I'm hoping 28, 30, 40, you're telling her 50. You're right. Listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Dr. Carol Scott. She's an emergency room physician and also radio personality, stressreliefradio.com. Also, optimalstress.com, another website. You can find information. You know, we're talking about the stress thing, and I get what you're saying, but are we wired to be able to let it go? I mean,
ooh,
are we wired to give up that kind of control? I mean, me, I'm told I can be kind of a control freakish.
Hey,
it's a matter of I can beat this. It's not something I have to just let go. It's my problem.
Well, you're calling it a problem. You're just human, normal like all of us. You're absolutely right. It's wiring. It is wiring. But the key is your wiring is just one component of it. It doesn't have to be your destiny. So that first thing I want you to do is get it out of your mind that that's who you are. Okay? Just get rid of it right now. Just say, I am wired, but it is not my destiny. Can you do that?
No.
Okay.
Because I like to believe that I can solve, it's a problem, I can solve whatever it is.
Okay.
And it's that, and I'm working on it, it's one of those working things, but it's a matter of, you know, when there's something, I've got to be able to fix it.
Okay.
It's that male mentality.
Well,
there's a problem, there's got to be a solution and a fix.
But I think that that's male and female, because I think that, particularly like you spoke about your wife, you got to admit, you know, she's fixing things that go on with your kids on a day-to-day basis, hour by hour.
She works much harder than I do.
Well, you know, you both work hard. So, you know, I'm all for, we all do what we have to do, and we do different things at different times in our lives, too. But to your point about being wired and control and letting it go, here are a couple thoughts about letting it go. Let me just bite one little piece of that. Well, let me back up. Control and predictability are the two most important components of stress. You hit it right on the head. I mean, you're a prototype. Control and predictability. And in fact, when you think about it, which is why my book is called Optimal Stress, we all really do enjoy stress. Because when you think about it, stress is that feeling that you have. Now, I'm talking about this process, but the emotional response when you feel that you're challenged, but at the same time, it's enjoyable. Think about it. We pay good money to get on a roller coaster to experience stress, right? And what is it that we're doing? We're getting rid of a little bit of a control, and there's a little bit of predictability that we give up, right? But we're just hoping that we're in a safe environment. We pay money for that. Think about it, okay?
That's a good point.
So, but what we want to do on a day-to-day basis is what we need to do, which is why optimal stress is the concept. The right amount and the right type is going to vary for each one of us. You know what you need, and I say that you can define those components for you based on what I call your three Ps, your priorities, your purpose, and your passions. You determine what are those stressors that are associated with it, and then you do a process that we do in the emergency department. You can triage them. I guarantee you some of the things that you're trying to control, if you were to deconstruct it, and there's some exercises in the book that can help you do this, if you were to deconstruct it, you would begin to recognize that a lot of these things are predictable and they are controllable. Then you'll find some things that are controllable that you don't need to control or even want to. You're going to take that component out of your mind. For instance, you just told me that your wife does a great job of running your household and taking care of your kids. I bet there are things that you've not discussed with her that she has completely mastered the ability to maintain the right level of everything for your household and your kids'
yep.
sanity, their health, their wellness.
I don't know about the sanity, but everything else.
But I would imagine that there are some components of that that you still carry a little guilt and a little worry around when you're on the road.
Oh, constantly.
So now what I'm going to invite you to do is have a conversation with your wife and say, the two of you agree on, these are the things that I'm going to take on, these are the things that you're going to take on. And then, again, it's personal preference, but if you believe in a higher power, some spiritual belief system, just address that spiritual power and say, this is something that I'm going to put in my wife's hand and your hands. And I can allow myself not to have this guilt or worry. Now, if you insist on having it, because you said, you know, you're wired to want to do it, why don't you say, why don't we touch base maybe on at 3 p.m, or maybe every Thursday, or maybe every other week, and let's have a check-in about how things are going with this. But in the meantime, unclutter your mind with it, unclutter your heart with it, and allow yourself the ability, number one, to experience less stress, but also you're going to be healthier. You're going to be less likely to do that behavioral thing of eating the wrong things. Let me tell you, 2 a.m. in the emergency department, you're waiting for that next case to come in, and we order Chinese food. Right? You know? So.
And then you're hungry again in 20 minutes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But you hear what I'm saying.
I do.
Is that helpful?
Absolutely it is. And I think it'll be very helpful for some other folks as well. Again, OptimalStress.com, StressReliefRadio.com. Last question I have for you, and bringing that back to this conference and really the reason that they're here defending the Healthcare Affordability Act, the Healthcare Act. How much of what you're talking about is in this new movement towards health care? How much of what you're talking about is being addressed?
I think it's being addressed on several layers, but in several layers and on different levels, but it's not explicit.
Okay.
You will not hear something about stress, but we're hearing about prevention for the first time. We're hearing about
that's
payments.
Important.
Very, very important. We're also hearing about there's a cycle that occurs. Think about it. If you know that you have a pre-existing condition, and you know that you're not going to be able to get health care, think of the ripple effect psychologically for you and for others. Absolutely. Let's also think about the fact that if you're a parent and you have kids that are older, and the fact that you know now that they'll be covered during that vulnerable period when otherwise you'd have to worry about, you know, catastrophic financial event, because we're all going to step up to the plate to the extent that we can if our kids have problems. So I think that it's there. I think that for each of us, what we need to do is support the fact that I need to take personal responsibility for rethinking how I frame stress. Instead of trying to get rid of stress, I'm going to be thinking about optimal stress, what's important and why. And I think that I need to make sure that I do the things that allow me to be healthy on a day-to-day basis and take advantage of the provisions that are in the Healthcare Affordability Act if we do, in fact, are able to live with that.
All right. Dr. Carol Scott, I appreciate your time. Again, OptimalStress.com, StressReliefRadio.com. If you want to hear more from Dr. Scott, you can listen to her program. Dr. Scott, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You have a great day. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
And then somebody tell you that you're on by someone else. Show up to the old house. It's money. Work it out. People of today are so tired of the lust. Their argument for freedom is how much will it cost? So what's it all about? It's money! Work it out! Money! Money! All around! Keep the game before it cracks you down! Down! Acting a crime! Stealing a time! Hungry jungle hunters with one on faded eyes! Mother Nature's army retreats to hide and cry. So what's it all about?
We're smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It just gives me more energy to continue doing my job.
United Steelworkers Subdistrict Director Manny Armenta, freed after being arrested this week in Mexico, while on his way to meet with lawyers for the Los Mineros Mexican Miners Union. He was arrested supposedly for driving a stolen car, but the car was leased to the union. After having the car impounded and being held in a cell for several hours, he was free, but $700 in cash was stolen from his wallet. The USW is filing a formal protest over the arrest with the U.S. State Department. Armenta and the USW are working to support Los Mineros. The Mexican miners are waging a nearly four-year strike with giant mining company Grupo Mexico. Armenta says the workers have suffered violent suppression from the company and the Mexican government.
There's been fatalities. There's been a lot of tear gas in some of the places they try to organize, and even in the places they're already organized and represent the workers. This week is just an indication of how corrupt the Mexican government is, along with the company, the Grupo Mexico, a very powerful company, and they obviously control a lot of the government officials.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The AFL-CIO and the International Association of Machinists are suing South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley for saying that the state will try to keep unions out of the new Boeing plant in Charleston. The suit in U.S. District Court seeks a court order telling the governor and her director of the South Carolina Department of Labor, Licensing and Regulation to remain neutral when it comes to union activities. Dubai is a city defined by its expensive living and eclectic ambition, but it isn't as well known for its willingness to let liquor abusers slide. Jesse Russell reports.
Construction workers in Dubai received a reminder about the lack of labor rights in the United Arab Emirates this week. An estimated 5,000 Arab tech construction workers went on strike in mid-January to demand a pay increase that would amount to $54 extra per month. Construction workers in Dubai, who are typically brought in from South Asia, earn on average the equivalent of $190 to $220 per month. Arab Tech Holding is the largest construction company in Dubai, and the workers are used for everything from building the skyscrapers that are increasingly springing up on the city's skyline to hotels. Public labor unrest is a rarity in the Emirates because workers often fear they'll be deported or arrested. In this case, 50 of the workers who went on strike are being sent packing due to their willingness to demand better wages in a country that has become known for its rampant excess.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborreport.org.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We are here in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference, Health Action 2011. The president is just about, well, he is speaking right now. I'm sitting here with Eleanor Clift, the famed columnist, pundit, television personality. Eleanor, thanks for taking time for me.
Glad to be here.
You know, I'm looking at some of the, before we get to talk about healthcare, looking at some of the international things going on. Egypt, for instance,
right.
A thing that shocked me, completely shut off the internet.
Yeah, apparently it's easier to do in a country like Egypt where they have more controls and the internet is not as prevalent as it is, say, in our country. It doesn't shock me because that's the first thing that a dictatorial government tries to do is to shut down the flow of information. I remember back when the Soviet Union was around, they treated typewriters like contraband because they didn't want anything that spread information, and they didn't have phone books, and you would go over there if it was possible to find anyone. The internet has really changed all that. And the uprising in Egypt is seen as a contagion from Tunisia, and it really has been enabled by social networking, and people can spontaneously gather. So the government in Egypt, I think, sees it as a big threat. But I'll tell you, I don't think you can turn this off once. And fortunately, they're using rubber bullets and water hoses, apparently, and they haven't used deadly force. And one of the questions is, what will the army do? Will the army stand with the people? Will the army follow orders? And so I think that the leadership of Hosni Mubarak now is very much in question. He's been in power for 30 years, and it may be time to transition to something new. But the scary thing for U.S. interests is, what will that something new be? And in this country, we're very afraid of radical Islamist regimes, and I don't think anybody quite knows who makes up this movement on the street and who the leaders are. The fact that Mohammed El-Baradei is over there, former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Nobel Peace Prize winner, he's now sided, he's an Egyptian, sided with the protesters. If somebody like him could come into power, that would be really nice. But, you know, it's uncertainty. And just like Wall Street doesn't like uncertainty, neither do governments.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and looking at this, you know, I'm starting to think of how the international right is going to look at this moving forward. How are they going to crack down? How are they going to view this moving forward?
Did you say the international right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think, first of all, the right in this country, the neoconservatives, will say that this proves their point that democracy can spread. And I think the left will say, okay, democracy can spread more easily through Facebook than it can at the end of a gun. If you want regime change, it's got to come up, bubble up from the bottom. You
right.
can't go in and overthrow regimes. So I think each side will find
their
something.
Ideology.
Yeah, that's right. We're all good at that.
But at the end of it, it's still the people in the streets, and it's
that's
still
right.
what's going to happen moving forward.
It's the people in the street, but then they need to have leaders. And maybe there are leaders over there, indigenous leaders, that they all know about and we just don't know about. But I think that's the part that we are worried about. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood is a movement in Egypt that is made up of more radical young men, basically. And Mubarak has not allowed any kind of protest, has really stamped them out. I don't know how big a factor they are. El-Baradei wrote an op-ed for Daily Beast in which he said that it is wrong to see any kind of revolutionary fervent as coming from the radical extremist side, that it's a whole rainbow of people, that there are secularists, there are moderates, and, you know, you've got to give other voices a chance. So I'd like to look at it that way.
Yeah, so would I.
Right. So,
because that's
we'll
the best
see.
Possible outcome.
That's the best possible outcome. And then you have to ask, what is the role for the U.S. government at this point? I imagine quietly, publicly, they've been calling on Mubarak to loosen up, thinking that that would let off some steam, I think. I think the moment for that may have been passed.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Eleanor Clift, famed TV pundit, columnist. You know, and as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, you know, this is what happens when you have poverty. This is what happens when you have mass unemployment and people are hungry.
Right.
I mean, this is the kind of stuff we're going to see, I think, spread across the globe.
Well,
and maybe even at some point down the road, as we right. keep talking about these austerity measures here in this country, maybe even here.
Yeah.
Which, getting back to what concerns me about this kill switch for the Internet they keep talking about.
Right. I guess I'm still idealistic enough about this country that I couldn't imagine them trying to get away with that, and I don't think they could. I think in Egypt you have 40% of the people live under $2 a day.
Right.
I don't know that those are the people who are necessarily out on the streets. I think it's a more educated class, and it's people who are educated and who are not able to get jobs.
Yeah,
and
that's
the
look here. Right. Look at the Tea Party people here. Those are the same exact people you're talking about. It wasn't the poor people. It wasn't where I grew up in the housing project on the west side of Cleveland. You didn't see them marching in the street. You saw middle-income people who, for the first time, mm-hmm. lost their jobs, saw their 401ks disappear. Those are the folks that took to the streets.
Populist movements from the right or from the left. That's where populism comes from. Although the Tea Party people, for the most part, they're doing pretty well. and they're not wanting to give up their government checks, and they're mad at government. I think it's... I think there's a difference there between...
But most of the Tea Party folks that I've met, mostly in my personal experience, these are folks who were told that, you know, they work at a job 30 years, they'll have $1 million in their 401k when they retire, but they're looking at reduced pay on the job, their 401k's in half.
The Tea Party people I meet are more worried about government getting too big and helping other people. I don't think they're the ones who are really hurting. But I have wondered sometimes why people, I lived through the 60s and people did go into the streets when they were unhappy about the war, they were unhappy about women's rights and civil rights. We don't do that anymore. And we do organize more through social media, but we have not reach the kind of critical mass that have sent people into the streets. I thought for a time, you know, Afghanistan, if there were more casualties in Afghanistan, that might spark something. Maybe. But I think the fact that progressives know that if the Taliban returns to power in Afghanistan, women will be treated pretty badly, that kind of makes you more ambivalent about just saying, well, we need to get out right now. So the issues have not presented themselves in such a clean way in this country to draw the kind of protests that we're seeing, say, in Egypt. In Egypt, apparently the food prices have really gone up, and a lot of educated people don't have jobs. And I think they're the ones who are in the streets.
And that comes back to, and like in this country, it comes back to the recession. Mm-hmm. I think it comes back to the economic stability of the globe. So I ask you, how much of this are we going to see moving forward in any of the other 100 countries?
Well, we don't know that there are happy endings here either, you know.
No,
and right now it's kind of an exuberant moment. Oh, this is all happening. What's going to happen? But again, there were uprisings that seemed beautiful at the beginning that were crushed brutally, but when the Soviet Union was in power, you think of Tiananmen Square.
Right.
And China has since liberalized, but, people lost their lives during that period.
Absolutely.
So, you have to temper your excitement about, ooh, democracy is spreading, to really be fearful that people could pay for this with their lives.
Yeah, because we're hearing reports that they're using rubber bullets. But, how much independent reporting are we actually getting out of them?
Right, right.
So
Iran was actually the last one of these events when that young woman was killed and became a martyr to the cause. And Iran looked like maybe it was on the verge of something, but they are sort of back to business as usual.
Yeah, I think Iran and Egypt are different places.
Right.
So we're here at this healthcare conference. I'm talking to Eleanor Cliff. In bringing this home with this healthcare thing, I'm really shocked that the Republicans have gone through with their little charade and that the American people haven't really revolted against taking healthcare away from people, especially a lot of the women that I've met. I think of one person in particular. Her two daughters had leukemia and they lost their house. They filed bankruptcy. All of these negative things because of the healthcare that we used to have. We don't really have all the good things in the new bill yet. But I'm curious why we haven't seen a revolt back from, like, a backlash yet.
Well, I think the healthcare bill has been so demonized that people think that they're going to be paying for health care for undeserving people. And the insurance companies, which were the demons, I thought, have now been given a pass, and government is the enemy. And the Tea Party in particular, they feel that the health care bill is an encroachment on their freedom. And I'm thinking freedom to what? To get
freedom
sick
to pay and die.
And be bankrupt? It doesn't make sense. But I think the Republicans had to go through this charade, and I think it is kind of a charade because it's what they ran on, and it's keeping faith with their base. They're not going to get repealed, but they have plenty of opportunities to make mischief. In the next 2 years, this White House is going to be fighting a rear guard battle to protect this law, to make sure it gets the funds to be implemented. There'll be court
and
challenges.
On the state level.
Court challenges probably go to the Supreme Court. So,
I live in a place like Pennsylvania, where we're from. You got a governor who signed on as attorney general to the laws, to the lawsuit. He's going to be in charge of implementing the exchange.
Right. Yeah.
How is that going to work out?
Right. I would only hope that some states that are really committed to this law, like California, which has huge numbers of people who are uninsured, will lead the way as they have.
And Vermont.
Yeah, and lead the way as they have in so many instances. And that the benefits of the bill will come into view. The networks, the exchanges, really won't be set up until 2013, 2014. 14. This will be a major issue in the 2012 presidential election. And if the Republicans are smart, they'll nominate a mainstream character like Mitt Romney or Tim Pawlenty. Now, Mitt Romney should be proud of the bill he passed or
right.
signed.
Into he's running
Romney.
Away from
he's
it.
He's running away from it. So Democrats shouldn't let him do that.
So what do you think of the whole Palin, the whole Bachman thing, pushing them out there as possible? are they just the extreme so people go, well, you know, Pawlenty and maybe Romney, not as bad?
Well, it could have that effect, but I don't think the Republican leadership has much control over Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachman.
What did you think of her response after the State of the Union?
Well, I didn't really watch it, but I caught many of the clips afterwards, and it did look kind of strange with her looking off to the side.
My first thought was that's what she needed a union cameraman to make sure she was looking into the right camera.
Well, no, she was looking into the right camera for her people because it was the web camera for Tea Party supporters. And, you know, CNN was just in there treating her like she was a rival presidential candidate, which maybe she is. And she wasn't going to look in their camera. So it's
wow.
It's fun and games.
Yeah, but, you know, that's why doing this is so much fun. You see something like that, and it gives you a whole week worth of fodder.
Right, exactly.
Because that person wants to be president.
I know. Well, actually, lots of people probably want to be president,
I don't want to live in that fishbowl.
Don't take the steps.
I don't want to live in that fishbowl.
Yeah.
I look at this guy who's president now, and I don't know how he doesn't wake up every day and, tell people where to go every day.
Yeah.
Because there's some pretty vile stuff being said about him and some pretty vile stuff that he has to put up with.
Right. Well, I know. He's amazingly even-tempered. And I think can pretty much intellectualize everything. And I think that's an advantage. It's a disadvantage sometimes when you want him to show some more emotion and, you know, get his base revved up. But I think in terms of surviving what the modern presidency is all about, that he's got the right temperament.
We shall see. Eleanor Clifton, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Isn't it nice to know that whenever America faces a big issue, Americans can always count on Congress to be there. For themselves, that is. Take health care. Corporate-funded front groups churned out a mess of lies to foment public opposition to Obama's rather modest insurance reform, demonizing it as a government takeover of our health care system. It was no such thing, but that hasn't stopped Republican lawmakers from making a theatrical show of trying to repeal Obama's reform and, quote, save the people from the horrors of socialized medicine. Yet, in all their blathering, none of them have offered to save themselves from the horror of taxpayer-provided health care. Congress critters get Cadillac coverage at our expense. Plus, they have their own in-house bevy of government doctors to attend to them. Why don't they vote to eliminate this privileged bastion of socialism? Then there's the real horror of gun violence that exploded most recently in Arizona. In response, members of Congress rushed forward with creative solutions. It's all about public safety, they exclaimed, by which they meant saving themselves from the public. Representative Peter King showed what he's made of by introducing legislation making it a federal crime to carry a gun within the vicinity of a congressperson. Representative Dan Burton proposed an emergency job creation program, which would consist of immediately sealing off the House gallery with bulletproof glass to shield the skittish Solons from the people. And a couple of members took a bold stand for individual responsibility by announcing that they would henceforth show their respect for constituents by packing pistols when going out amongst them. This is Jim Hightower saying, good grief! Don't they do enough damage by shooting off their mouths? I don't know about you, but I don't think congresspeople should be trusted with real guns.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm sitting here with Dr. Daniel Beers. He is the director of Early Stages. Is
that correct?
What is Early Stages?
Early Stages is the diagnostic center for special education for D.C. public schools. We offer state-of-the-art diagnostic services to all children ages 3 to 5 in D.C. to make sure that they're determined whether or not they're eligible for special education early, so that they can get in and get started with services and have better educational outcomes over the long term.
Well, that sounds like a smart thing to do. The earlier you catch things, maybe the better outcomes you have over the long haul? Yeah.
Sure. We know that 90% of the brain is developed by age 5, and so we have this critical window of opportunity to really impact long-term outcomes. And if we know we have kids with disabilities, we can certainly change the trajectory if we can get them engaged early in the educational process and make sure that they're getting the services they need to do any catch-up that they need to do so that they're ready to learn by the time they hit kindergarten.
And looking at this healthcare bill that we're kind of celebrating and looking forward to, how much of what you do is addressed in that?
It's a very important piece of making sure that the kids are ready to learn. Certainly, as a pediatrician working within the education system, my goal is the interface between health and education systems. And so making sure that kids who have chronic medical conditions or kids who come to the table and may not have received adequate health care to date, that we're making sure that they get plugged in and so that they're ready to learn and available to be educated. Because if they're not healthy, they're not going to be ready to learn.
Give me some examples, maybe a story or two that you've worked on.
So, for instance, we've had families who've come in who have had poor medical care and have not been able to get speech services or occupational services that they should have been getting prior to turning 3. We've been able to get them started and get those services and make sure that they can turn around the process from where they were. We have children with autism who medical needs as well, who may be underweight because they haven't been eating, because they're restricting their diet as part of their behavioral manifestations of autism. And so helping families get connected into the health systems and getting good nutritional support and educational support and medical support is part of making sure that the child's holistically cared for through the process.
And a lot of this, to me, sounds just like preventative care, going to a pediatrician. You know, I got to be honest, with my 3 kids, we had a very good relationship with our doctors. We were fortunate we had very good health care that allowed for that. But, you know, I think of some people who may not and may not know what the developmental stages are. Does this law, what we're talking about, help any of that?
Sure. I think we're very fortunate here in D.C. that we had very progressive health care legislation to start with and had a Medicaid that was covering up to 300% of poverty. And so we had very few underinsured children in D.C., but still 9% of our kids were uninsured. And so making sure that those kids have access. And then the bigger issue for us that's being resolved is supporting the health care regulations around making sure that kids – with chronic medical conditions can't be thrown off of plans or capped out because they've spent their lifetime limit. That's really important for the kids who we serve who may have very complex medical conditions and may put their families at high financial risk if they're not appropriately insured. And so we're really pleased to make sure that we can connect those families with the health system, make sure they know their rights with the health system, make sure they know what to demand and what they should be expecting from the health system as well as the educational system.
Yeah, you talk about the caps, and I don't think most people realize that most health insurance plans had a cap until this whole discussion. And I think there are a lot of practices that the health insurance industry was getting away with that now we're finally starting to see that, you know, $1 million in healthcare is not an awful lot of money these days.
Right, and I think we're, as I said previously, very fortunate in D.C. We have progressive healthcare legislation regulations in place that required that insurance plans, including private insurance plans, paid for habilitative care. That's the care that a child needs to develop a skill. So if you aren't yet speaking, many health plans wouldn't cover that service. If you lost the ability to speak because you had a stroke or had some traumatic accident, they would cover that service. But if you hadn't yet learned how to speak, they were saying that that wasn't their responsibility. And in D.C., we have legislation and regulations that support making sure that those health insurance plans are required to cover those services. But that wasn't true in many jurisdictions. And so
let's focus on that for a second, because I think that's pretty substantial. It's huge. If a child doesn't learn to speak, by the time they get to be school age, that could be a massive expense, not only on the school district, but also on society as a whole, where if you at some point were able to correct that, and I assume that's fairly, not simple, I shouldn't say, but it is correctable early.
It's more straightforward than many other more complex developmental issues, for sure. I think we have good documented evidence that even very mild speech delays can lead to long-term disabilities. So a child who has a mild speech delay is at higher risk for a reading disability later in life, and certainly that increases the needs that the child has during the education, but that child with a reading disability is going to have increased needs that society is going to need to support for the long term. If they don't develop the same educational capacity, they're not going to be as highly employable. They're going to have a harder time supporting themselves independently. All of those things are long-term consequences of not dealing with the problem early. And so dealing with that speech delay on an early side of things means that they're less likely to have that reading disability, less likely to have long-term special ed needs, and less likely to continue to need societal support.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Dr. Nathaniel Beers, Director of Early Stages in the Office of Special Education in the D.C. Public Schools. How many other states are doing what you guys are doing here?
Every state is required to serve these children, ages 3 to 5, in addition to the older children as well. What we're doing is different in the way that we're providing this service. So we have a centralized process that is using a multidisciplinary team and has a more holistic approach to making sure that we're integrating the health and educational services. And there are a number of states that are moving this direction, and we continue to be proud of the progress that we've made in increasing the number of kids who we've been able to serve, increasing the number of kids we've been able to screen, and increasing the number of kids who've been evaluated in our system.
And looking at it, like a cost-benefit analysis, if you will, you know, how many kids are we talking about as a percentage, and how much do you think over the period of a lifespan do you think it saves the taxpayer, it saves society in some negative costs going forward?
So the cost-benefit analysis is pretty striking, and there have been some very high-powered economists who've been doing some analysis around early engagement with children. And there's evidence that shows for every dollar that we spend on early educational services for kids with special needs, that we save $7 over the course of that child's lifetime till they're 18.
Wow.
When you look at the educational system plus the health and social service systems that they end up needing if we don't engage early. And that's pretty powerful. Certainly, we're all looking to save some money.
Sure.
In local governments and state and federal governments. And so
not
this is a very powerful way to
improve people's lives.
Sure. And certainly make people more productive members of society over the long term. As far as the number of kids who we're talking about here in D.C. when we came on board in July of 2009, about 2% of children were being served, about 400 kids a year were being served through the process. We had a tenfold increase in the number of kids who we screened in a year. We had a threefold increase in the number of kids who needed evaluations, and we served them with evaluations. and doubled the number of kids who were eligible for services in a single year. And so we're pretty proud of that and know we have a lot of work to continue to improve.
Sure.
The national average is about 6% of kids, 3 to 5 have special education needs, and most urban jurisdictions are at about 10 to 12%. And so we still have some catching up to do, but we've made a lot of progress in taking us from 2 to 4%, and we expect to continue to make progress over the next several years.
Why the difference between the two areas? Between, I guess, the urban areas and the other areas?
Certainly, the poverty rates have something to do with the types of educational backgrounds that families have. The increased risk of developmental delays is there. The increased rates of prematurity in urban areas, drug use, HIV rates, as well as lead poisoning rates all contribute to increased rates of developmental disabilities in urban jurisdictions.
So those aren't things you could really...
We can't control for them, but right. We can intervene early and make sure that kids are getting served early so they don't have long-term needs.
And I would assume some prenatal care, which I think is part of the bill as well, some prevention stuff, in the gestation period.
Sure. I think the health care reform bill augments what we are able to do at early stages and certainly increase the access to care for pregnant women, making sure that they're getting good, high-quality prenatal care, making sure that they have early access to pediatric care when that child is born, and that they are able to see a pediatrician who's able to do regular, ongoing developmental screening to make sure that their primary care is of high quality.
Yeah. Let me last question I have. When my children were, I still have a 2-year-old, but when they were babies and maturing and going through this process, as I was learning about the developmental process, we were in constant contact with our pediatrician. But what about those folks who don't have that good fortune? What kind of things should they be looking for? What kind of things would in the development process, would you suggest?
So I think the first and most powerful thing that we can do for families is help them feel empowered to know that if they're worried, they need to ask for help. Because parents, even parents who don't have regular access to their pediatricians or medical care, are often worried well before anybody asks them whether or not they're worried. And so parents need to trust their instincts and ask for help early if they have concerns. In addition, they want to sort of keep some major milestones in the back of their head as sort of things that they should be aware of. Kids should be engaging with you in some type of social format and feel like you're getting some back and forth with them by the age of 6 months. If you're not getting that type of response from them, there's something going on that's keeping them from doing that, and someone should take a look at that child. The other big milestones to be aware of is that children should have at least one word by 1 year of age. So if they're not using something to label something that's important in their life with a single word that they use on a regular basis besides labeling their parents, then there's something that should be assessed within that child's life. And if a child isn't walking by 15 months of life, they should also be assessed. We expect kids to start to speak in little phrases by age 2. So if they're not combining words together by age 2, then certainly we start to have more worries about their language development. And if they're not starting to tell us little stories by the time they're close to 3, then, again, that's telling us that they're not meeting that language milestone that's a really critical component of their long-term success.
Excellent points. You know, what happens if they speak in volumes and they never stop?
We have to appreciate that.
Because I've got 3 of those.
I have 2 of those as well.
2, 4, and 8, and they never stop. Dr. Nathaniel Beers, I appreciate your time. Director of Early Stages at the Office of Special Education here in the D.C. Public Schools. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Another copy of the kids are in here. And we're still working like friends. There's only one thing I'm asking.
welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm sitting here with Ali Narani. He's the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. Ali, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
You know, we spent the whole day pretty much talking about healthcare, but I wanted to spend a little time talking about some other things because there are other things outside of the healthcare debate right now. One of them being immigration reform. You know, a lot of people, there's a lot of demonization, a lot of problems out there. Where do we begin in this whole discussion?
Well, I think we begin with what is important to the country. I mean, to solve any big problem, I think we have to think about it, what's in the nation's interests. And we have come to believe over many years of work and after talking to a lot of people is that it's in the nation's interest to fix our immigration system in a way that secures our borders in a way that makes taxpayers out of everybody, in a way that we actually have an immigration system that serves our economy and our families. At this point, our immigration system isn't serving anybody except the crooked employer who wants to exploit the American worker as well as the immigrant worker. So it's high time we got to work.
Absolutely. You know, and it's great that you brought up the fact that we need to bring people out of the shadows and make sure that the jobs that are being done by undocumented workers are rewarded and are compensated fairly so that everybody has a shot at it.
Absolutely. I think there's a big misconception across the country that undocumented workers are in this for the easy dollar, or in this for the benefit or the welfare benefit.
No, they're in it to feed their families.
They're in it to feed their families, exactly. And the fact is that as long as undocumented workers are living in the shadows and can be exploited by that crooked employer pushes down their wages, pushes down the wages of that labor member, that organized labor member working next to them. You know, they both lose, the crooked employer wins, and that employer down the street who's playing by the rules, he or she loses as well. I mean, so what it comes down to is that Democrats and Republicans need to come together, require people to get right with the law, get legal status, pay their taxes, go through a criminal background check, and let's get moving forward.
Yeah, because we, honestly and truthfully, looking at the demographics of this country, we absolutely need younger people coming in.
Absolutely. I mean, the country is changing. It's getting older. It's getting much more diverse. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing because that's who we've always been as a nation of immigrants and a nation that changes with time. And we, as all of us get older, we're going to need young people to fill those jobs, to contribute to the tax base, and, frankly, keep Social Security solvent.
Well, there's that. And, you know, as I say to some of my baby boomer friends, you're going to need someone to wipe your nose. We don't have enough people to do that yet.
Right.
Down the road, when the baby boom generation gets into their advanced years, we don't have the number of people needed to take care of them.
You know, and just to kind of tie it a little bit to the health care bill, one of the things out of the Affordable Care Act is this focus on the workforce. How do we make sure that the workforce is changing not only culturally with the population, but also just in terms of age, so that as the nurses are retiring, as personal care attendants are retiring, and they get older, there's an influx of new workers coming in that can just, frankly, take care of us.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But where do we begin in this? Because what's happened is the federal government really has abdicated their responsibility for almost a generation now.
Right.
And then you have craziness, like in Arizona, like we're talking about in Pennsylvania with Daryl Metcalf and his insanity. This is what happens when you don't have leadership from the top.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I mean, the leadership has to start from the top. And that means that the president, John Boehner, Harry Reid need to get in a room and say, okay, how are we going to fix this problem? And it's very simple when you think about it. Number one, we have to, like I said earlier, require those who are undocumented to become legal. Require them to pay their taxes, go through a background check, and get right with the law. Number two, we need to secure our borders and our interior. Number three, we actually have to have a functioning immigration system that can fluctuate with the needs of our economy. At this point, there are only 5,000 low-skill visas available across the country per year. Across the country per year.
Wow.
Now, I know that there are a lot of people out of work right now, and a lot of people are really hurting. And I'm not dismissing that because it's reality. But to have an economy so dependent on workers, native-born and immigrant, but only have 5,000 visas available, that's how you end up with this problem. I mean, that's a big part of the fix.
Isn't it also part of the fix maybe taking a look at Mexico and some of the Latin American countries that are, yep. are I got to be honest, if I'm mm-hmm. if I'm on the southern end of that border yep. and I'm looking across into Texas, I'm looking across into Arizona, mm-hmm. where I'm going to be able to feed my families, it's not going to take me long to figure out sure. what I'm going to do. And one of the things that we talk about on this program is you look back at NAFTA and you look at the destruction of the farming communities. What did we expect?
I mean, NAFTA, for all of the really tough things that it did for so many people, the tragedy for the Mexican farmer is something that very few people understand. In fact, you know, Mexico used to grow and eat its own corn.
Yep.
Now imports all the corn that it needs. So that means a tortilla will cost 3-4 times as much. And it means that farmer is out of work. So when that farmer in Mexico is out of work, they come to the farms in the U.S. But what's happening right now, because our immigration system is so out of whack, those farms that are in the U.S., so that every one agricultural worker, every one farmhand, creates three jobs, upstream and downstream. And there are a lot of people picking raw crops. But right now, at this point, about 80% of the farm workers in this country are undocumented. If they are deported in mass numbers like Lamar Smith wants to see, those farms will move south. So not only are those jobs south, but those three for jobs for everyone, they move as well.
Right.
So it's very complicated, but I think we just have to have some grown-ups sit around and get to a solution.
And that's the key, grown-ups.
Yep.
People who are going to look at the situation and say, you know what, we're not going to pander to the reactionary. We're not going to pander to the racist. We're going to look at the country and its needs and move forward. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Ali Narani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. There have been some really bizarre ideas about having people come in, this idea of chipping, guest worker programs, mm-hmm. all of this stuff doesn't seem to me to be the best idea. I want people who want to come to this country, become citizens,
right.
and be part of our culture. I don't want guest workers. I don't want right. that kind of temporary second-class citizen right. here. I don't think it's good for the country. Because I don't think you have people who have a stake in it, though.
We couldn't agree more. I mean, if we don't have a society where everybody is treated equally and everybody can become a citizen, we become, Europe is struggling with this. I mean, you have France and Germany where politicians decide who is a citizen. Our nation was founded on a constitution that said if you're born here, you are a citizen. If you have come here, you will go through a process to become a naturalized citizen. If we go backwards from that, we're going down a slippery slope that a lot of countries are really struggling with. And I think guest worker programs, any worker program has to have a pathway to permanent residency and citizenship. That's just a no-brainer.
I'm right there with you. You know, one of the things that I always talk about is, you look at the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, your poor, mm-hmm. your huddled masses,
right.
yearning to breathe free. But, the average citizen now, the reactionary, the one that's catching news headlines, mm-hmm. Those are the folks who are saying, no, well, our parents came here legally when there wasn't really a legal path. You just came. You showed up.
I mean, we didn't have a legal immigration system really till 1924. But you know what? I got to, we talk as an organization to people on the left and on the right. And when we talk to the folks who may not agree with us, when we talk about the humanity of this and talk about that Mexican farmer who is out of work and has a family who just wants to make ends meet, and you talk about that person, then that person who, that extremist says, you know what, this is about people. And this is about we as a country who care about people. And
if we're this grand Christian nation that we're told we are.
Exactly.
Then that's the perfect.
Do unto others.
Because you tell that story, and most people don't understand that the Mexican government had to change their constitution
mm-hmm.
in order to become part of NAFTA.
Yep.
And you go through and you say, look, they stole land from these communities that they used to farm.
Mm-hmm.
And they, the price of corn, they can't even buy the seeds for what we can sell them finished product for.
Right.
It starts to click.
Right.
When all these workers are thrown off their land and sent to the maquiladoras on the north, and there's no work there, where do they go?
Yeah. I was talking to a woman I've gotten to know in Pennsylvania who does a lot of work on the other side of the issue, and she was telling me a story where, the Italians, when they came to the country, they actually had to go into the Catholic churches, but they were forced to pray in the basement because the Irish above wouldn't let them pray in the main area, the main chamber, I guess. Those are stories that just remind people of the immigrant history and the tension that this isn't new.
Right.
This is always this is gone.
Just the next,
and
next
we, you know, we've always been a good enough nation to get through it, and I think we still are.
Yeah. In going along that line, now looking at this from a different perspective. It does come down to the economy. It does come down to building our economy, but also maybe looking at Mexico and saying, you know, the government there's got to get control of that country so that we don't keep seeing the people want to stay home, because I truly believe that most people, they want to stay in their home country. They want to be able to feed their families. They want the same thing you and I want.
Right.
They want to exist and prosper.
Our families came because there's better opportunities here. If they had better opportunities where they came from, they would have stayed. So there is two sides to this. One is that we have to have an immigration system that serves our economy and our workforce, but we also have to have a relationship with Mexico and other countries that promotes their development. Promotes their ability to move forward as a nation, and some of that is you know, making sure that we're not, you know, sending drugs and guns south.
That's a good point. Last question, your last line of questioning. You know, we look at this immigration thing as maybe it's haphazard, but there's an infrastructure here. I was told by one of my friends who works in the immigration, kind of on the issue like you do, that 80% of the people who come here in an undocumented fashion have jobs before they leave their home.
So that number in particular is. 40% of people will come here because on a tourist visa or work visa, and they'll overstay that visa. You know, about 50 to 60% will cross the border. But you're absolutely right. The majority of them will come because they have family here, they have friends here who have lined up a job already and have lined up and said, you know what, you can get here and you can work hard to make ends meet. If you're here legally, you're not eligible for social benefits for 5 years. If you're undocumented, you're not eligible for anything.
So I love that line. I love the line. Well, they're taking our Social Security. They're taking our health care. They're taking, and to bring it back to health care here, they're taking all of these programs. I'm going, but they're here in an illegal status.
Right.
Do you think you're going to go, you're breaking a crime, you're going to walk in and say, hey, look at me?
Right.
Of course
not.
It's, and the other thing is that people are paying taxes, whether it's income taxes or sales taxes or you know, real estate taxes. People are contributing. If we were to legalize 11 million people in this country, as that number is now, we'd actually create $1.5 trillion in economic growth over 10 years. You know, $250 billion in tax revenue right out of the gates. Those are huge numbers that we need right now.
Absolutely. Last question. We went down this line, but where do we go? Where is this going to go in the next couple of months?
Yep.
Are we seeing the political will to solve this?
I'm not sure. This is really going to come down to, you know, will the extremist wing of the Republican Party win the day? And that means that they will push a strategy of mass deportations, but they will also end up with a strategy that leaves them, frankly, outside of the White House for generations to come. Republicans have to do something good on immigration in order to get Latino and Asian and immigrant voters into their tents. I think within the Senate, we'll see some movement, some proactive movement. It's a little bit unclear what that path will look like. But you know what? At the end of the day, the president is going to have to lean into this. The president is going to have to say, this is something that I want to see. This is something that I want to get done. And it's a priority.
And you can't push it off on another administration.
Exactly.
Ali Noorani, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. I'll take a quick break. We'll get back after that.
To the last of us, fight till we die.
The blue lights see red.
We're working people. Help
the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark ages.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I'm sitting here with Antoinette Krause, Project Director for the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Antoinette, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I look at the fact that the governor has... no longer governor-elect, the governor is talking about doing away with the adult basic plan, something, again, that I think is a huge mistake. How do we begin to stop this? What do we do from here if this is intent and this is what he does?
Yeah, so Governor Corbett has now sent out letters, the insurance department has, informing people that they will lose health coverage on February 28th. The administration has given several solutions to the problem, both of which are completely unacceptable.
And there, well, if I'm not mistaken, there are 42,000 people on this adult basic right now, and another 120,000, 150,000 waiting to get on?
There is about 42,000 people on the program. The waiting list is actually over 400,000 people.
Wow. So it's even larger than I thought.
Yeah, it continues to grow, especially with the economy the way it is. We see it grow by hundreds of thousands pretty quickly.
So for those who don't know what Adult Basic is, exactly what are we talking about here?
So Adult Basic is a health insurance program for working adults. They are individuals that can't qualify for Medicaid, and they fall between 200% of poverty, but they don't make enough to be able to buy insurance on the private market. A lot of them have pre-existing conditions or ailments that it would cost them thousands of dollars to get health insurance. Currently, most of them get it at $36 a month.
Which seems reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. We've met with a lot of people, and we've heard a lot of stories, especially since Governor Corbett said we're ending this program, of people that have been on the program since it started, and they just couldn't get health insurance anywhere else. They called around. It was $800 or $900, so Adult Basic really saved their lives and gave them a chance at having health insurance coverage.
Under this plan, they're paying $36 a month for this health care. Where does the rest of the money come from?
So the program was originally started under Governor Ridge, who used tobacco settlement money. And then Governor Rendell said, well, we want to expand this program. And at the same time, there was a huge outcry in the state because Blue Cross, which is nonprofit health insurance, so they get tax breaks, had huge surpluses. So there was an outcry, and Governor Rendell negotiated with them to put in more money to the Adult Basic program. And over time, they've contributed more and more money. So the Blues fund about 60 to 70% of Adult Basic currently.
And what does he want to move this to? I mean, okay, I get it. You want to do away with the Adult Basic. What are proposing anything else,
so,
or just tough luck, buddy?
So he's come out with two proposals, which are pretty much tough luck to everybody. But his first proposal was for people on Adult Basic to move to a program called Special Care. It would be about 300 to 400% more expensive.
Well, that's special.
Depending on where you are in the state. In most places, it limits you to 4 doctor visits a year. That's everything specialist, primary care. So after 4 doctor's visits, you're left uninsurable. And
there's nothing special about that.
No. And most of the people on Adult Basic have serious illnesses and go to the doctor sometimes 4 times in a week. So
let me ask you this. If they can, the people who you're talking about who can no longer go to the doctor, they can no longer then work if they get sick, then what happens to them? Then they can be eligible for Medicaid? Is that how this kind of works? If you're poor enough, you can get health insurance?
Yeah, basically. So if
and
they
it's
can't,
kind of a perverse incentive, don't you think?
Yeah. So for a lot of these individuals, if they don't get health coverage, they'll end up in the emergency room. They won't be able to go to work. They might lose their job. Then they have no income and could go on Medicaid. So it's just this ridiculous cycle.
And without money, they could probably be homeless, but at least they'll have health care.
Right.
Because, and I bring that up for a reason. You know, a couple years ago, during one of our food drives, we met a guy who that happened to. He lost his job, he had a heart attack, ended up losing his job, lost his insurance, lost his home, went on Medicaid. We were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars keeping this guy alive, and he was homeless, living out on the streets. And it just seemed to be kind of stupid to me.
Yeah, and I mean, for people that go to the emergency room that don't have health insurance, someone has to pay for that, and we end up paying for that anyway. So it's just ridiculous.
Through higher premiums. And you know, I look at this Families USA Health Conference, you know, touting the Health Reform Act that was passed, or the Affordable Care Act that was passed. You know, again, another one of these problems, another one of these patchwork programs where I wish we could just put everything together. We didn't have to, you didn't have Medicare, Medicaid, Adult Basic, this special, this, that. We would have one plan that everyone was involved in. That was my vision for it.
Right.
But I don't think this bill has done much of that.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the major provisions don't take place until 2014. And that's what we're saying to Governor Corbett. We're not asking them to come up with a solution for Adult Basic that's going to be in place for 25 years. We're asking for 2-3 years until the exchanges are set up.
To bridge the gap.
And we're at a critical place. We understand that budgets are tight. But the Blues could put money into this. Again, they're nonprofit. They get charitable, or they have to give charitable contributions because they get tax breaks. And their surpluses, since they started putting money into Adult Basic, have grown from $3.4 billion almost up to $6 billion. Wow. So they have the money.
They do, but do you think it's them so much as it is the governor? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to do pretty much what they're mandated to do.
Right, and if you look at a lot of who our governor has had on his transition team or appointed into office, they come from the insurance industry or special interest groups. So it says a lot of where our governor's priorities are. And, I mean, I would ask him, what side are you on? Are you on the side of the big insurance companies, or are you on the side of individuals in Pennsylvania who are struggling every day with health care?
I don't think he actually needs to answer that. We already know he's on the side of the big insurers and the drillers and the big corporations. I think that's borne out in, as you pointed out, the people that he's appointed.
Right.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Antoinette Krauss. She is with the Pennsylvania Health Access Network Project Director for the state of Pennsylvania. You know, going forward to this, you're planning rallies and events, trying to get people organized. And that's really what's going to have to happen in the coming months and couple of years as we move towards the health exchanges that are going to be set up in our state by a guy who's against the health care bill. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, and so with the whole Adult Basic thing, Corbett, during his campaign, said he supported the six-month extension. Before he's even in office, 3 days before he gets in office, he says, well, forget about Adult Basic. We're going to put people on this crappy health insurance plan. So we're really worried about what that means in Pennsylvania for implementation of health care reform moving forward.
And if someone wanted to get involved, you know, the type of activities you guys do, what would they do?
So you can go to our website. It's pahealthaccess.org. You can also visit us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. And we have tons of stuff on there. We have petitions to save Adult Basic, to tell Tom Corbett we need to implement health care. And we just need everyone to get involved.
And you know, I think it's important that we identify with people who, you know, could be us. At any day, most of us are one illness, one job loss away from catastrophe, away from bankruptcy or homelessness or any number of tragedies. Can you share with me a couple of stories of the people that you've met who this has helped and maybe some of the things that they're looking forward to in the event it goes away?
For Adult Basic?
Yes.
So we have one woman. She lives in Bucks County. She has several illnesses, three or four illnesses. She was actually Googling on the Internet looking on how to help her friend get into Adult Basic, and then she found out it was ending. She called us in tears because she has doctor's appointments almost every single week, and without going to the doctor, she can't get prescribed medicine, which she needs to live. On Monday, we heard from O.J. Kaufman, who is from the Pittsburgh area. He has prostate cancer. He's in a stage right now where they're monitoring him, but they expect that he's going to need chemotherapy. And if it happens after February 28th, he has no idea what he's going to do. He might have to deplete all of his savings in order to stay alive, and that's just not right.
And this is the thing about, I think, that most people don't know about insurance. There's a whole different variety of them. And what we're talking about with the Adult Basic, it is a basic plan. This is not the Cadillac plan that our legislators have or the senators or congressmen have. This is a very basic, bare-bones, high-cost plan.
Yeah, I mean, it's in its name, Adult Basic. It's very basic, bare-bones. O.J. Kaufman, who I just talked about, he said if this is bare bones, what Corbett is proposing is essentially no bones. We're not fighting for an amazing health care plan, but again, it's to bridge the gap to get people to 2014 when they can get health insurance through the exchanges.
When is your next action?
We are right now in a stage where we're gathering more petition signatures. We delivered over 4,000 to Governor Corbett about 2 weeks ago. We're going to continue to collect those and visit with our legislators. We're also putting together a movie of Adult Basic stories from all across the state, spliced with some of Governor Corbett's statements. So we'll be releasing
that
next week.
Look forward to that. Maybe we'll put up on our website at the Richmond Show.com. Antoinette Krause, I appreciate your time. Pennsylvania Health Access Network Project Director. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been The Rick Smith Show. Thanks for listening. And if you missed any part of the program, remember, go to therickSmithShow.com and download any portion of the program. We look forward to being back live in the studio on Monday, and we look forward to your calls.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tidal flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, impenetrable.